Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
A grown woman get on a kid's network, you know what I mean, and go off on a kid.
A Collinsville mother outraged tonight. She says her 12-year-old son is being bullied by his classmates' parents. I'm Sharon Reed.
And I'm Maurice Drummond, in for Steve Savard. News 4's Brittany Noble Jones is in Collinsville with the Bomarito Street Fleet. It's a story you'll see only on News 4. Brittany?
Marie's mom tells me she's not sure how long her son has been bullied because he was afraid to speak up and tell her. But now that she knows, she wants the mother on the other end to be held responsible.
Nicole B. Coates is outraged about the messages sent from an adult to her son's phone. Now she's reaching out to police for help.
Bring it on, you. No, you're not dead. That black thing there that looks like his eyes are crossed is, though.
B. Coates says another mom in Collinsville uses voice text to bully her 12-year-old. According to her, this all started because he didn't want to date a girl in his class.
These kids happen to be my kids, so why don't you get your black off here?
She called him an alien from out of space. She called him, like I said, a numerous She also said something about my 20-year-old that got on to try to defend his brother.
20-year-old Devin Dean tried to step in after seeing his younger brother visibly upset.
I was asking him what was wrong. You know, he looked sad, looking at his phone, and he told me he was arguing with this girl and her mother. So I looked at it. I was like, wow.
But instead of defusing the situation, he too became a target. Here's the message where she calls them two big, tough darkies.
He doesn't want to have to keep watching behind his back because they threaten him about the police, her husband being a lieutenant, and things that they can have done.
Now the little boy, hearing all of this, is scared for his life.
I'm going to take the extra mile for my little brother. I feel like, you know, people don't stand up for themselves these days. People just let things slide by, and now's the time to start really standing up for yourself.
So the principal at the school said that he cannot talk about individual cases. However, police here at the Collinsville Police Department are taking this case very, very seriously. As for the woman responsible for the messages, I did reach out to her, but my calls have not been returned. Reporting live in Collinsville, Brittany Noble Jones, News 4.
See, black people, we're in the same situation that the Semites of the Jewish religion were in under Adolf Hitler. See, under Adolf Hitler, and every black person ought to go to the library, go to the bookstore, and get some books on what was happening in Nazi Germany.
And welcome back. Most of us don't use the word propaganda the way it's defined. It means information designed to promote a cause, but it's usually understood differently when lies and deception have been used to promote that cause. In many ways, Adolf Hitler's Nazi party set the standard in that regard. Hitler referred to it as a horrible weapon in the hands of an expert. Two exhibits, that is, are taking place in St. Louis dedicated to Nazi propaganda. The Missouri History Museum is currently running an exhibit through September 7th titled State of Deception, The Power of Nazi Propaganda. At the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and Learning Center, the exhibit, Capturing Hearts and Minds, Images of Nazi Propaganda and Disinformation, will run through September 20th. Joining me in studio are Adam Kloppe, Writing and Research Fellow at the Missouri History Museum, and Dan Rich is Curator and Director of Education at the St. Louis Holocaust Museum and Learning Center. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Adam, let me ask you, as we have a sense now of what's going on out in the Creve Coeur area, give me some sense of what's happening at the History Museum.
Well, right. So at the Missouri History Museum, we brought in this exhibit, State of Deception, that was developed by the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. They developed it several years ago. It's been touring around the country for a couple years. It's been touring since 2011. It's been to Cleveland and Kansas City and Chicago and a few different other places. And we brought it in here because it is such a powerful, such a big show. That's a really important thing for people to have the experience to learn about and to be able to see. And so we brought it here so that the people of St. Louis could see this, you know, world-class exhibit that's been other places right here in their own backyard.
Why is it so important now?
Well, it's really important, I think, to understand what propaganda is and how it works, right? And it's important also not to lose the stories of the people who were touched by the evil that was unleashed by Nazi propaganda in particular. And I think this show does a really good job of showing how that propaganda actually works. It doesn't treat Nazi propaganda as something that, you know, is fully formed from the outset, but how they target propaganda to different groups, how they use propaganda towards different ends. So, you know, it's really taking a hard look at how propaganda works and how it unleashed this kind of evil in Germany in the 1930s.
Dan, the Hitler and the Third Reich made an art form out of propaganda, did it not?
Very much so. And yeah. I think continuing on what Adam said, those lessons of propaganda are very much still with us today. What is the source of what we're reading? What is the source of what we're hearing? Is there manipulation going on? And I think that's part of both of the exhibits.
Do you agree with my earlier definition that of propaganda, that we tend to think of it always as negative, but the United States, for instance, is involved in propaganda? The Voice of America is a propaganda organization.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ed.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that your definition is right on. And part of, I think, what the exhibit shows is that, you know, we can find elements of propaganda, you know, in advertising, in political ads, and all these different things. Nazi propaganda, of course, there's a difference in intent and, you know, a difference too, like you said, we're able to get out there and find out all sorts of different information. You know, if you see an ad for a particular soda pop or something, let's say, you know, you can go out and find information about, well, where they're lying to you about it. And in Nazi Germany, information, you know, obviously there's a different intent behind it between that and a soda pop ad. And there was a vacuum of information. The Nazis didn't allow other forms of information to be out there. They brutally suppressed other viewpoints. So I think that, you know, what the show does is it teaches you to be really vigilant about where you see propaganda in your life today, like Dan was saying, but it also doesn't want you to make easy comparisons necessarily between the past and the present.
It brings us back to the subject of media literacy and really using your critical thinking skills to understand what you're looking at. Dan, give me a sense, if you will, based on what you're showing out there at your center, as how propaganda was used against the Jews, for instance, in Germany.
Well, again, there's this positive side of promoting yourself. Mm-hmm. So we've got some wonderful stereograph images from the Goldstein collection that really show Hitler as a man of the people and relating and the sense of youthful energy of the Nazi Party. But the negative side was demonizing the other, demonizing the Jewish people, blaming the Jews for all of the misfortune of the time. And we've got quite a bit of that material as well.
You know, and just thinking what Adam has said with regard to going elsewhere to find out, you know, the truth, that wasn't possible in Nazi Germany because the only place you could go was state-controlled and therefore just would corroborate anything that would be used as part of the propaganda process.
Very much so. And certainly, I would say the History Museum show really emphasizes the limits, the use of radio, the use of phonographs, etc., and the limits on any media that was not conveying the message that this group wanted disseminated. Mm-hmm.
Can you give me some examples of the kinds of things that you have specifically that might be on the more dramatic side or easier to understand for a radio audience?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the show has a lot of reproductions of Nazi propaganda posters that were produced in the 1930s in Germany, and they were, you know, hung on, you know, the sides of roads and on walls and things like this. And those are, you know, obviously very powerful pieces. And what the Holocaust Museum has done that I think is a really powerful way to convey that information is, you know, they have the big reproduction of it with the original German text on it, the way it was produced in the 1930s. And then they have a smaller version of that poster underneath where the text has been translated into English. So now you're reading it in English and you're seeing the visual imagery at the same time, right? And that's a very powerful way to take in the messages that the posters were trying to get across, as opposed to, you know, reading the English text on a label and then going back. So that's one way that that really hits you. They've also produced several videos the Holocaust Museum did to introduce, you know, timelines and things like that. And, you know, you can, they have footage from rallies and footage from different events that happened in Nazi Germany. And to see those and to see them in succession like that, it really shows the power that this propaganda had to reach people in a moment when they couldn't access that those other forms of information because media had been purged from opposing viewpoints.
I'd like to point out to our audience that we have some examples of the things we're talking about on our website at stlpublicradio.org. And I suppose going to your websites also would give some example of the kinds of things we're talking about. You know, one of the things I remember about this particular era was the use of film, and you've alluded to that, Adam, and Leni Riefenstahl, who produced so many of the films for Hitler. Is her work included in what you have, or work like hers?
Well, there are clips from films that were produced by the Reich Ministry of Propaganda within the films produced by the Holocaust Museum. There's four films that they used to introduce the four different sections of the exhibit, and there's two other films that fill in, you know, information about. Mm-hmm. One of them is particularly how the Nazis used films to demonize the Jewish people. So there's clips in there from films, entertainment films and documentaries that the Nazis produced that were propaganda films to try to get Germans to turn against the Jewish people. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there are clips from films like that in the exhibit.
And Dan, that was a relatively new medium back in the 30s, certainly. Leni Riefenstahl, learned how to use it very effectively.
Extremely. Now, we don't have film in our exhibit, but we've got photographs that show, again, the energized new branding of the National Socialists. There's also a very popular, a very powerful book from the Jacobi collection about the Jew as criminal that just shows different images of the different evil faces that the Jew could have. So that kind of imagery was really exploited to convey these messages.
And one thing, too, that I think, you know, Dan is talking about and we've talked about a little bit is, you know, the Nazis really using these, like you said, these new technologies to reach people. They were obsessed with using things like, you know, phonographs to record speeches, and then they would play them in loudspeakers in squares for people to listen to. They were obsessed with creating radios and giving them to people in the 1930s or selling them very, very cheaply. And they would promote this as the Nazis are modernizing Germany by getting these radios, this new technology to people. But they would also limit how much access could come in on those radios. You couldn't pick up foreign signals. You could only pick up Nazi signals and things like that. So they're also using these radios to get propaganda into people's homes to try to get them to internalize that.
King Kong ain't got shit on me!
You is kind. You is smart. You is important.
What's happening, hot stuff?
His name is Long Duck Dong. Long Duck Dong.
All right. He hosts the Vice series Wong's World and is the author of Fresh Off the Boat, a memoir. Eddie Wong is over here. Eddie. Hey, great to meet you. How you doing?
Definitely.
Eddie, how you doing?
I'm good. How you
doing?
I'm
so glad we have you on. We don't have nearly as many Asian Americans as we should have on.
Yeah, I mean, have you had any? When was the last Asian American you had on here?
You stumped me.
David
we had Tiger Mom.
You ever had David Carradine?
David Carradine?
Yeah, Kung Fu the Legend Continues.
Is he Asian?
No, I figured you had him, though.
So your sitcom is doing very well, Fresh Off the Boat. But before we get to your interesting background, I want to know about the sitcom, because you must be happy it's doing well, and yet I know you are a little pissed off at the sitcom itself for not fulfilling the dream as you saw it. So should we watch it or should we boycott it?
No, I think the thing is, you know, the success of the show doesn't make me happy or unhappy. I don't care. I don't care if people watch it or not watch it. I think people should make their own decision what they feel about this show. And that's why I've been speaking out, because I go to colleges, I talk to kids, I go on Twitter and I see their responses. And there's a lot of Asians out there that feel pressure to like this show. And they have issues with it. They see issues with it. But they don't want to say anything because they're like, we finally got invited to the party. We're right. Finally having reflections and representations of
but
ourselves.
But I feel like you wanted to break the stereotype. And then you got caught in the Hollywood mill and you found out, no, the Hollywood feels, no, it better to use the stereotypes. Is that what happened?
Yeah. I mean, they want to tell universal white stories with yellow faces, black faces, brown faces, but they tell the same universal story. And you go watch how these sitcoms are made in writers' rooms. They're like labs, dude. It's like GMO food they're making.
Right. You're right. But I got to... I know there are more important issues than this, but you mentioned this. I never got the yellow thing. I don't see Asian people as yellow. I have never seen yellow. When I don't see colors that great, but you're not... I see you as a yellow person.
I just go with it so that I can claim the emojis as my people.
Okay.
You know?
All right. I'm glad we got that cleared up. So who do the Asians cheat off of when they take a test?
Jewish people.
Jewish people. Well, that's interesting, because you say the way to understand Asians is through the Jewish family. You say there's a lot of parallels.
There's a ton of parallels.
Like what?
Bagels, bows. Right?
Bagels what?
Bagels and bows. Breakfast items.
I don't know what that is.
Laundromats. We're both excellent with the laundromat game.
Oh, right.
Yeah. We're both excellent with the accounting game. Right? Cash businesses. We love cash businesses. Right? Your parents want you to be doctors, lawyers, accountants?
That's right. Well, that's such an interesting thing. Here, riddle me this one. Okay, so... When we think of the stereotype of Asia, we think, well, Western man is proactive.
Yeah.
Eastern man is more fatalistic.
Yeah.
And yet, when they come to America, they're so super ambitious. To the point where they drive their kids hard. I think, you know, your memoir says your father was kind of cruel.
Yeah,
and it kind of and it comes from, I want you people to succeed. That's the Tiger Mom thing. Not fatalistic at all.
No, we have a lot of pressure to succeed, to be successful.
Yes.
But it's in a very defined way. It's not success to the individual. It's success to the greater society, to the family, to the 5,000 years of history. Like, if I could count how many times. Yeah, my mom, like, if I didn't do well in algebra, she's like, you are letting down 5,000 years of history.
Is that
right?
True?
Yeah. And she's like, you have disappointed me 8 lifetimes. I'm like, why 8? And she's like, I feel like I've been reincarnated 8 times, and you've let me down for all 8 times.
No. That's
so
tough.
You always carry the weight of everybody with you,
right.
You know?
Do you do impressions of your family? A lot of people do.
I'm not very good at impressions, especially, like, not on the spot. But, no, I'm not. My brother's better at it. He likes to imitate Vietnamese people at faux spots. That's his thing. That's his thing.
But I also find it...
They don't want him to do it on the show, though.
No, of course
not. They don't want him to do it on the show.
It's interesting that, you know, you found sort of your savior in a couple of things. Food, You know, I mean, you were, when you were a kid, you moved to Orlando, you were picked on, you were different, your lunch smelled funny, right?
Yeah, I still smell funny, but my lunch smells better.
Right. Yeah. Well, now that you're rich, nobody cares what you smell like.
Nobody cares. My car is yellow. Nobody cares.
That's right. But, yeah, I mean, and hip-hop, you know, this was something you related to because you felt like, oh, I'm an outsider and they're speaking as outsiders, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like Asian men have been emasculated so much in America that we're basically treated like black women. So I related a lot to Tupacalypse, Me Against the World, and like when I sit on OK Cupid, I'm just like, no one wants to talk to me either.
I think it's great that you make them uncomfortable.
Yeah. Like,
you know, that's, we need more of that.
Yeah. I mean, like, that's the thing with sitcoms, right? It's like, if you keep telling jokes people have already heard, and, and like, you write these sitcoms, and then they go in to test them with people, and they have dials. They're literally watching the show, turning the dials, and what happens is they'll say, oh, that joke didn't land, the dials turned left. Oh, that joke landed, it turned right. And they go back to the writer's room, and they're like, right to the test. And it's very strange. It's a strange way to make artwork. You write a book, you probably do it in your home. I write a book, I don't even have pants on.
Right. All right. One more Asian question, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sure. As long as I love representing the entire country of people.
I just want to know, why did the word Oriental become a I understand why the N-word is horrible, but I don't understand why, like, one day it was like, well, that's an insult.
I don't know.
See?
I mean,
you don't know.
People have told me it is an insult,
right.
But I claim it. I say I'm Oriental, really? Like rugs and Five Spice.
Right.
Yeah.
And what about Chinaman?
I'm down. It's the preferred nomenclature, right?
All right.
Just don't piss on my rug.
Right. Okay. All right. I know you know a lot about criminal justice. You went to law school.
Yes, I did.
Isn't
I worked at the
something?
Innocence Project for a year while I was there. But yeah, went to law school.
Then this is perfect for you and the panel. This was a big story in the news this week. This is from the Washington Post. The Justice Department and FBI have formally acknowledged that nearly every examiner in an elite FBI forensic unit gave flawed testimony in almost all trials in which they offered evidence for two decades before the year 2000, including 32 people who were put to death. This is astounding. They reviewed 268 trials. 95% of them, they said, they overstated forensic matches in a way that favored prosecutors. Wow. You know, I gotta say, this country, tough on the innocent.
We begin today's show in Baltimore, where protests over the death of Freddie Gray have entered their fifth day. The 27-year-old African-American man died Sunday from spinal injuries, 1 week after Baltimore police arrested him. His family and attorney say his voice box was crushed and his spine was, quote, 80% severed at his neck. A preliminary autopsy report showed Gray died of a spinal injury. Video shot by a bystander shows Gray screaming in apparent agony as police drag him to a van.
Another witness said the police bent Freddie Gray like a pretzel. Gray was then held inside a police van for 30 minutes. Police said, quote, during transport to Western District via wagon transport, the defendant suffered a medical emergency and was immediately transported to shock trauma via medic. The Department of Justice is now investigating Gray's death for possible civil rights violations. Since 2011, Baltimore has paid roughly $6.3 million to settle police misconduct claims. Baltimore authorities say five of the six officers involved in the arrest of Gray have now given statements to the Baltimore police. One has not. They remain suspended with pay. Baltimore Police Union attorney Michael Davey told reporters the officers were right to chase Gray, after he ran away when a lieutenant made eye contact with him.
They pursued Mr. Gray. They detained him for an investigative stop. Had he not had a knife or an illegal weapon on him, he would have been released. They know what role they played in the arrest of Mr. Gray. What we don't know and what we're hoping the investigation will tell us is what happened inside the back of the van. He was placed in the transport van. Whether he was seatbelted in, I don't believe he was. Our position is something happened in that van. We just don't know what.
Do you think any of the six officers committed a crime that day?
No.
Unequivocally, and what makes you say?
Based on the information that I know, no.
Well, on Wednesday, our next guest spoke with residents of the Gilmore Homes housing projects in West Baltimore, where Freddie Gray was arrested, including one woman who says she witnessed officers loading him into the back of a police van. In a minute, we'll be joined by our guest, Eddie Conway of the Real News Network. But first, this is a clip of his interview.
How you doing? I'm Eddie Conway.
I'm Famika.
Okay.
And I'm Jacqueline Jackson. I've seen it.
Yeah.
I live 1628 Mountmore Court. My kitchen faces Mount Street.
Okay.
The paddy wagon was right there. They took the young man out, beat him some more. The man wasn't responding. They took him by his pants, and he was dragging. Mm-hmm. And I asked them to call an ambulance. They told me to mind my business. Mm-hmm. I told them it is my business.
Mm-hmm.
And they just threw him up in there. The boy wasn't hollering or nothing. And mm-hmm. he wasn't hollering or nothing. How can you holler if you ain't saying nothing?
Mm-hmm.
They killed that young man. They killed him.
Eddie Conway of the Real News Network interviewing residents of the Gilmore Homes housing project where Freddie Gray was arrested. He was there last night when protesters called for justice in his case, marched again. And he joins us now in Baltimore. Eddie Conway is executive producer of the Real News Network, also a former Black Panther leader in Baltimore, Maryland, who was released from prison last year after serving 44 years for a murder he denies committing. We spoke to him last March, just 24 hours after he was released. We're also joined by Dominique Stevenson, who was arrested at last night's protest in Baltimore over the death of Freddie Gray. She's program director for the American Friends Service Committee's Friend of a Friend program, which fosters the peaceful resolution of conflict and promotes reconciliation and healing inside Maryland's criminal justice system. She's also co-author of Eddie Conway's memoir, Martial Law, The Life and Times of a Baltimore Black Panther. Dominique, let's begin with you. Can you explain why you were protesting yesterday and how you got arrested?
Well, I was protesting because there's a history in Baltimore of not so much police shootings, but people being beaten to death by the police. There's a long history. I feel that I needed to be there with the community. We had for some time been doing work in Gilmore Homes Housing Project, and I wanted to, you know, be there to stand in solidarity with the community. I was arrested because at some point a young woman, Michaela Price, decided to commit civil disobedience. She's 17 years old. I, one, did not want or even trust her being in police custody alone, and so I came over the barrier to accompany her.
Dominique, the state of Maryland also has the highest—Baltimore has the highest rate of incarceration in the state of Maryland. Could you connect that to the action that you took and to what happened to Freddie Gray?
Yes. One, if you look at statistics, that particular neighborhood, Sandtown Winchester is the neighborhood in Baltimore, has actually the highest incarceration rate in the state. And you cannot disconnect that rate of incarceration from the style of aggressive policing that takes place. We've talked to many young men. Okay, of course, there's crime in that community. There are no jobs in that community. There's no economic development happening in that community. But the other issue is the harassment of police, the unnecessary detainment of police. People don't know what Freddie Gray's history may have been with those folks that he saw and why making eye contact simply made him run. And so I think that we really need to take a look at how policing is done in Baltimore. And it cannot be disconnected from our high incarceration rate. Black folks make up almost 80% of the total population in the Maryland prison system, yet we comprise about 28% of the population in the state.
Eddie Conway, you were interviewing people in the area. We just saw you talking to a witness. This issue of there being video of Freddie Gray in the takedown when they are dragging him over to the or trying to carry him over to the police van— It looks like he cannot move. Yesterday, the police union spokesperson, attorney, said, oh, you know, that's what these perps do. They have to be dragged because they won't walk. Can you respond to this based on what you heard from witnesses?
Yes, and I interviewed perhaps 30 people from that community that was in that area or either heard the incident or witnessed the incident. The incident actually occurred under one of the police cameras that has been operating for years in that community, and they have been using that camera to make numerous drug arrests over the years. And for some reason, that day, that camera did not work. It would have been directly over Freddie Gray's head. It would have recorded everything that took place. One of the things that people say that one of the police dropped down on his back, on his neck with his knee. And from that point on, he was incapacitated. And later, they even took him back out of the van and shackled his legs and did something else to him and threw him back in the van. So as far as all the witnesses can tell, and all of them report, that he was already fatally injured when they put him in the first place. That video that we saw with them dragging him to the van, he was already incapacitated.
And has anyone, Eddie Conway, given an explanation for why that camera didn't work that day?
No one knows why that camera didn't work. Everybody in the community says that that camera has been used consistently over the years to lock people up and used for evidence in drug arrests and in other arrests. One of the things is, and I guess I want to raise this issue, when is it a crime for a man to run somewhere? People run throughout the city all the time. People are constantly running. So you get executed because you run?
Now, can you clarify, for people who haven't been following this case, the police union attorney yesterday said in a high-crime area, yes, you can arrest someone if they simply run. And no one alleges anything other than that Freddie Gray ran. What about this?
Well, it's not a high-crime area. It's a Broken Windows police area in which people and residents in that area are arrested for sitting on their own steps. They are loitering in their own community on their own steps, and they're harassed constantly. And this have been the reports that I have received. The Real News and myself and friend of a friend, we have been going down in that area trying to establish a relationship with the people in that area. And one of the things that they said is that they're not even allowed to set out in the area on their steps, even though they live there. With the police will come and harass them. That level of harassment causes verbal responses. It causes physical contact. It causes people to be arrested. And before you know it, they have an arrest record. Even as I'm talking 10, 11, 12, 13-year-old juveniles, and they end up in the prison system, and that's why that becomes the high crime system, the high crime area.
A statement from the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 3, Baltimore's police union, compared the protesters calling for justice in the death of Freddie Gray to a lynch mob. During a news conference Wednesday, reporters questioned the union's president about the comparison.
I just was reading this statement you all just handed out to us just now, and just reading it, the tone, I mean, it says that the images on TV look and sound much like a lynch mob. Are you, I mean, what are you having?
I haven't seen that.
Because they've already tried and convicted the officers, and that's just unfair. They still get their day in court. They did not give up their constitutional rights when they became a law enforcement officer. That's what I was getting at. To that, some of the protesters and some of the stuff I've been watching on the news, they want them put in prison. Well, they have been charged. Number one, number two, they still get their day in court. So how can they request that they be put in jail? We haven't even got to that process yet. The investigation has to be completed before we move forward.
Right, but are you concerned with the tone of the statement at all?
No, because I was quite offended by some of the things that were being said yesterday. Me personally, that's coming from me. That didn't come from Mike in the law firm.
This says it comes from the Fraternal Order of
yes,
Police.
That's so. I'm the president.
So, are you likening these citizens protesting in this rally to a lynch mob, specifically?
Well, let's put it this way: if they're tried, convicted, and they would have put them in jail, where's the due process with that?
That's Gene Ryan, the police union president. Dominique Stevenson, this likening to a lynch mob. Yesterday, you did get arrested. You went over the barrier. What is your reaction to the police union president?
Well, actually, if you take a look at what happened to Freddie Gray, he was tried, convicted, and executed. And so I resent likening people who are simply protesting and demonstrating and responding to a situation that was extremely unjust in their community to a lynch mob. As a person of African descent and understanding the history of lynching in this country, I find that statement offensive. I think that people are very frustrated because this is not the first time that this situation has occurred in Baltimore. I think that people have spent years of seeing these situations occur. People have experienced police brutality on so many levels, whether it's witnessing the mistreatment of loved ones or community members or experiencing it firsthand. There were so many people in the community yesterday who were willing to come up and talk about their experiences with the police, that this is something that has been so harmful to Black communities across the country, but particularly here in Baltimore. So I think that it is basically it's a statement designed to garner attention and to garner a response. I think that people have a right to protest. They should continue to do that. But along with that, we need to really begin to organize. We need to take control of how policing is done in our communities. And that will begin to resolve some of the problems.
We need that perfect hair.
Who exactly are you, man? What's going on? All you do is ask me where the hell I am, who I'm with, what I'm buying. You always act like a motherfucking cop, man. This shit is bullshit, man. I'm free. I'm free. Let me be free.
I want to be a cop.
In Tulsa County, Oklahoma, Robert Bates has pleaded not guilty to manslaughter. He's the 73-year-old volunteer reserve deputy who shot and killed an unarmed Black man during a sting operation. Bates says it was an accident, that he meant to use his taser. The high-profile case has raised concerns about the way law enforcement agencies use volunteers who often have badges and guns. Here's NPR's Martin Costi.
Bob Ball is a real estate investor in Portland, Oregon, but that's his day job. For the last 20 years, he's also been a volunteer cop.
When I was new, it was the best time of my life. I got to go out there and wear a white hat and help people and make a difference in my community, kind of one little piece at a time.
And this is real police work. On one occasion, Ball had to pull his gun on a guy who was threatening a woman with a knife.
He ended up dropping the knife, and I didn't shoot. And when they were asking me, how come you didn't shoot, time sort of slows down a little bit, too, when you get adrenaline. And in my case, I saw his eyes get afraid.
Not shooting that guy earned Ball a medal for valor. But police reserve programs vary a lot. Some departments restrict their duties to things like handling crowds, while others let the reservists go on patrol and make arrests. Volunteer police are a long-standing tradition in America. Think of the Old West sheriff swearing in a posse. And some police professionals say it's a tradition that deserves to end.
Law enforcement is one of the few professions that allows people to play at the profession.
Ray Johnson is the police chief in Chesterfield, Missouri. It's a suburb of St. Louis. Police reservists have always made him nervous. He recalls a program in another town where he worked early in his career.
They were just loose cannons. They were not properly supervised. They were not properly trained. We had reserve officers who were business people in the community, but they would come in on a Saturday, two of them, and take a car and go out and patrol the streets.
So when Johnson was hired to run his own department in Chesterfield, he made it a priority to get rid of the reservists. There was political pressure to keep the program, so he did it in stages, slowly restricting the volunteers' police powers. He says he doesn't think all police reservists are loose cannons. Quite the contrary, he says many are serious and dedicated.
Because they're doing it as an avocation. They have all the enthusiasm for that as other people do for some other hobby, but it is a hobby.
And when you're volunteering just 20 hours a month, he says you don't develop the practical experience you need as a cop. Also, your training tends to fade. How often that ends up getting someone hurt or killed, we just don't know. There are no good national statistics on reservists using force. Johnson says he thinks the reservists are being reined in more these days, especially in metro areas like St. Louis. He has a sideline as a reviewer of police departments for the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies. And he says the reserve programs now seem to be more common in small towns.
Too often we find in small rural departments, especially, that someone on the council has friends that may be prominent, you know, people in the community that want to play cop.
The bigger departments that still use reservists have either restricted their powers or they've gone for more training. That's what they did in Portland. Officer John Shadron is the coordinator of the program there.
We looked at it years ago the same way people are looking at it now and tried to get ahead of it. So now you get the exact same yearly training that full-time officers do.
But why put so much effort into training volunteers? Shadron says with a tight police budget, Portland just plain needs them.
Population's growing and we just have less people out on the street. So having a reserve officer, right now we're doing just about every day, we've got at least three or four cars who are doubled up because you'll have one full-time paid officer who will be riding with a reserve officer.
More than anything, it's money, or a lack thereof, that keeps the American tradition of volunteer police alive. Martin Costi, NPR News.
I want to be a cop! I want to be a cop.
Now, crossing continents, and I should warn you that there is some very strong language in the programme as James Fletcher travels to Lisbon to investigate whether Portugal has a problem with police brutality and racism.
The sun is shining and the music's playing here in Cova da Moura. There's a car pulled up with a big set of speakers in it playing Funaná, which is typical Cape Verdean music.
We take the streets as our space to interact with the people. Everybody know each other here. The human connection, that's something that disappears in a lot of big cities. In Cova da Moura, you have a lot of human connection.
For this week's Crossing Continents, meet Flavio Almada. With his slim-fitting leather jacket, black-rimmed glasses and goatee, he has a hint of a street-savvy Malcolm X about him. It's hard to imagine someone more humanly connected than Flavio. He knows everyone here. Flavio is a social worker, activist and rapper, but he's now also at the centre of a story about alleged police brutality and racism in Portugal, and all because he went to help someone.
And it was quickly. He shoot.
Immediately, I was shot again in the leg.
They said, you are lucky that the law doesn't allow. Because if law allow, you will be executed.
But first, to understand what happened, I've come to where it began. A colourful and controversial neighbourhood on the outskirts of Lisbon, called Cova da Moura. This place was originally established after World War II by workers from Portugal's former African colonies. Some from Angola, Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau, and a majority, like Flavio, from Cape Verde. Poverty and discrimination pushed them here, to the fringes of Lisbon, and they started building their own houses on a hill. We're walking down a hill now. The streets are a bit rough, there are potholes in the road surfaces in great numbers. Besides the houses, they're three- and four-storey buildings. The first thing you notice is everything's painted. It's so colourful. There's graffiti, amazing graffiti. There's a huge picture of Martin Luther King as you come in.
It's a rich place with a rich culture, with a lot of culture. There's a lot of creativity. There's a lot of energy. People that can give a good contribution.
Much of the art here is the product of an organisation called Moinho da Juventude, or the Mill of Youth. It started in the early 80s to fight for services and political rights for locals here and has grown to provide Cova de Moura's 6,000 residents with everything from education to advocacy to inspiring street art, winning a human rights prize from Portugal's parliament along the way.
The walls, they teach, is a way to teach with art.
So as you walk around the streets here, you're getting lessons, even just walking around the streets and looking at the walls.
Yeah, you get lessons. These walls tell stories.
One wall tells a story that's come to define Cova de Moura and many of Portugal's other poor immigrant neighbourhoods. It's a faded black stencil of a young man being searched by a policeman who presses his gun against the back of the young man's head. While people like Flavio love this place for its warmth, community and creativity, for the rest of Portugal, Cova de Moura is often a byword for drugs, crime and violence and troubled relations with the police. This is a video of a recent police raid in Cova de Moura, filmed by a local resident. In the early hours of the morning, police with shotguns and wearing balaclavas can be seen walking through the streets and heard firing rubber bullets. Locals say a young man was hit in the head. One policeman shouts abuse at someone and is seen picking up a rock and hurling it down the street. These police are part of what's known as a rapid intervention team, more highly trained and heavily equipped, more like riot police, and normally only called in when a situation escalates beyond what the regular police can handle.
We call them paramilitaries. You know, you come with the big guns, for what? You know, children sitting.
How often are they on the ground here in the neighborhood?
All day long. They are here always, you know, always running fast, you know, sometimes acting like a delinquent. You fear them, you know, when you see them, your arms start to shake, you say, oh my God. It's like, yeah, we should not have a fear. Sure that we have a fear.
Afeta muito, porque eu trabalho com os meninos de 6 anos até aos 18.
She works with children from 6 years old to 18 years old. And it's complicated because they try to teach them that the policeman is a friend and someone they can go to, and then the reality is completely the opposite.
I'm with my translator Carla, and we're talking to Wasiza Magalhães. She's a teacher and part of the management of Moinho da Juventude. She says she's been subjected to crude and highly offensive racial slurs by the police.
One day, policemen were here, they were searching for something. I was approached, someone asked me my ID. I said I was late, I had to go to the university, and they said, but black people study. Quando eu say preto, os pretos estudam. Yeah, it's different. When they say preto, it's almost the equivalent of nigger. It doesn't have the same history, but it's the equivalent.
Eu sinto isso. Sinto que eles não se importam quem esteja a ver, do respeito pelo outro.
They don't care about who's seeing when they're doing, and they're brutalizing people. In the last few years, it has gotten worse.
It's not hard to find stories like these. Another young guy I met has family in both London and Cova de Moura.
In London, yeah, there's no police brutality at all, but here, police just, like, if they ask you to stop or something, yeah, you don't stop, or you ignore them or something, they shoot at you or start kicking you, hit you with sticks, and they don't really like black people.
You get the feeling that it is racist, that there's something in the police that they don't like black people?
They don't like, they dislike and they hate black people.
This isn't how most Portuguese see themselves. Several officials reminded me that one study ranks Portugal the second best place in the world for the integration of immigrants, and there's little anti-immigrant political rhetoric here. There's even an idea called Lusotropicalism, that the Portuguese were better colonisers than the British or French because they encouraged intermarriage, and this bolsters a strong sense today that this isn't a racist country. Official statistics don't shed much light on whether this is true or not, because, in the name of colourblindness, the government doesn't collect statistics on race. But if only a fraction of the many stories I heard are true, Portugal might have more of a problem than it thinks. This was made clear recently because of something that happened to Flavio, and some other young men from Covadamura.
It was blood on the ground there.
On the stair there?
Yeah, yeah. Even days later, it was blood on the wall.
On February 5th this year, around the middle of the day, a police rapid intervention team were in Covadamura. The police claim a young man called Bruno threw a rock at their van, breaking the window and injuring an officer. Bruno and locals who witnessed the incident deny this and say Bruno was singled out and badly beaten by the police in the street here.
Jails lives here.
Jailza was mopping the floor of her balcony overlooking the street and saw what happened. She says people began to protest that the police were using too much force and that the police reacted with their shotguns.
Okay, then a policeman came in this direction and he came walking and then he pointed a gun.
E eu tava com a esfregona torcer para lavar o chão.
Then she was washing the floor, and then the cop shot her. It hit her against the chest. And then when she was trying not to fall, the policeman just cocked his gun again, and he shot her again. It hit her on the hip.
So we've come into the house. Jazza's pulled an envelope out of her handbag there, and there's a letter inside here.
It's a medical report.
The medical report describes the wounds to Jailza's hip and chest caused by rubber bullets fired by the policeman.
And was he aiming at you or he was just firing and you happened to be hit?
No. Foi mesmo para mim mesmo.
Yes, it was aimed at her because he hit her twice. If he had hit her by chance, he wouldn't aim for the second one.
Como eu disse, não sou contra eles fizerem o trabalho deles. Queremos sim.
I'm not against them doing their jobs. I want them to be here doing their jobs, but they have to respect us because they don't respect elders, they don't respect children. They treat us like animals.
Good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Yo almoço.
Quer entrar? Let's come in.
Flavio takes me to meet Celso Lopes. Both work for Moinho, and in the past, both have mediated between the community and police. So, when the police left Covadamura that day, it was decided that Flavio and Celso would go to the police station to find out what had happened to Bruno. They were accompanied by around five other young men who'd witnessed the incident. When they arrived at the station, Celso says they found three policemen standing outside.
One was blocking the entrance. And then we said, why can't we enter? And he was like, no way, you ain't going to enter here, blah, 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 blah. And Flavio said, but this is a public space. Why can't we enter?
And two of those officers went in. And then I hear someone say, guys.
And suddenly about, 15, 20 cops, they came with the sticks, they came with the shotgun, and they started trying to kick us and punch us, to hit us with a bat.
And I say, okay.
You're putting your hands up now.
I'm leaving. But in the middle of this, the guy was automatically...
So you're making the motion of cocking shotgun.
And it was quickly. He shoot.
And he hit me in the leg. Immediately, I was shot again in the leg.
When the bullet hit the Celso did an expression. Flavio, are you seeing what they are doing?
You've thrown your arms out to the side, sort of almost shrugging your shoulders.
Yeah, you see what they are doing.
Flavio, Celso and three others were taken inside the police station. They allege the beatings continued, accompanied by racist abuse and humiliation, in language that some listeners might find offensive.
They say dogs and shit is on the ground. They said you are lucky that the law doesn't allow. Because if law allow, you will be executed. And was so scared. The humiliation, the insult was present always.
Flavio claims there's one comment in particular that sticks in his mind.
I will never forget his face. I will never forget his words. In Portuguese, he said, "Preto do caralho, vocês não sabem quanto eu vos odeio. Se eu tivesse poder, vocês seriam todos exterminados. Mas não se preocupem, isso não falta muito, falta pouco."
The phrase translates as, "You fucking niggers, you don't know how much I hate you. If I had the power, you would all be exterminated. But don't worry, it won't be long."
The sound was with emotion, with the conviction. I could see the eyes, like the way that he said that. He say, if I had a power, you would be all terminated. Like you nigger, you must die. You must die.
Eventually, all five men were admitted to hospital, and pictures taken at the time show their faces with cuts, swelling and chipped and missing teeth. Celso suffered a substantial leg wound from the rubber buckshot. Portuguese media also reported that a police officer was taken to hospital with a broken arm. The men were eventually charged with invading the police station and bailed by the judge.
The police say that you guys invaded the police station. How do you respond to that?
These people is crazy. How is possible a people that work with the Organization of Human Rights will go invade one police station with just pen, books, diary, and a wallet? Two things. Police is lying. Other thing, or we are crazy. So call the psychiatry. He put us there. Because if you go there, we are crazy. We are a suicide. They know that society will believe it when it's related with the black people.
This incident was so serious that it's now the subject of four different investigations and proceedings. As well as the charges the men face, they're pressing their own charges against the police for torture and racism. The Interior Ministry and Portugal's Racial Discrimination Commission are also investigating the conduct of the police. But the Discrimination Commission has upheld fewer than 10 complaints against the police in the past 10 years, and activists claim that 14 young black men have been killed by police since 2001, with no police officers punished. Flavio and Celso don't have a lot of faith in the system.
Oh, how I love the system!
I want to be a cop. Yeah. I want to be a cop.
Well, good news in Parma, Missouri. They've got change. Now, look, not everybody's in favor of the change. The person who won the mayoral race there is a new mayor. She hasn't been mayor before. She was a city clerk in the past. And she's done missionary work, etc. Her name is Tyrus Bird, okay? Now, she only won by 37 votes, but she's participating in the process. She won, so that's wonderful. People participated in the democratic process. Great news, right, overall? No, not for some in Parma, Missouri. It's a fairly small town, but apparently a lot of the people who worked there were upset and decided to quit. Who led the charge? The cops. Five out of the six police officers in the town resigned immediately because of who became mayor. By the way, if you're unclear about what they're concerned about, I'll tell you their official concern in a second. She happens to be the first female and African-American mayor of that town. I'm sure a wild coincidence that that's why they happened to quit when she became elected mayor. No, but they say it is because of her. Don't get me wrong. I'll tell you their official reason in a second. But they're not alone, not just the cops. The city attorney also quit. So did the clerk. And the wastewater treatment plant supervisor. The guy who deals with the sewage is like, no, she's not good enough for me. You know what? I'm so glad that they quit. Get the fuck out of here, man. You don't want to do your job because the people of your town elected a new mayor. Well, that's your problem, man. Go somewhere else where, you know, where you find like-minded people and go deal with their sewage. So what's their concern? Why they quit? They said, quote, because of safety concerns. What the fuck does that mean, safety concerns? Safety over what? She does missionary work. What do you mean, safety concerns? Come on, man. This is beyond the pale. And they have a black mayor for the first time who's worked in the government before. She's born and raised in that town. And she's exemplary person. No, I got safety concerns. The dude working the sewage plant's got safety concerns. The city attorney's got safety concerns. What safety concerns are you alluding to? If I was her, though, I'd be thrilled with this. Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. I'd had to deal with your stupid racist ass the whole time when I was mayor. Thank you for weeding yourselves out immediately. Good. You're fired. You're free to go. Get the hell out of here. No, better yet, you quit. I don't even have to pay you unemployment or anything. Depends on the laws of Missouri. Still, get the fuck out. Okay? Jesus Christ, man. Oh, we have a black president. Everything's all right. Racism is cured. And for those of you who say, well, you don't know it's because of racism. What do you think it's about? She was going to ambush him, but with missionary work? That's what they were concerned about? Now, oh my God, we have somebody actually representing the community. Heaven forbid!
Let me speculate on the safety concerns. Again, I mean, we've mentioned this before. These particular people who probably have an issue, of course, we're speculating wildly, with her race and probably the fact she's a woman as well. They put themselves in a position of how they feel about her, and they're thinking, well, she must feel that way about me. So if I was in charge, I would continue to not represent certain people, certain aspects of our society. So then she's going to do that to me now. She's turning the tables because I'm a heartless asshole who's racist or who's bigoted and who doesn't care about anyone else but people like me. She's going to do this to us now. Oh, my God, I'm in trouble. Because they think that's how everyone thinks, because that's how their mind works.
Now, that's a great point by JR. As always, classic projection. I know that when I was in charge, I never looked out for people like her. I only looked out for my own. Since she's in charge now, I assume that she's as bad a person as I am, so she'll only look out for her own. Well, I'm not her own, so I got to go. Okay, good riddance.
Yeah, and since we're talking about ropes, white folks, what you know about ropes? Yeah, what you know about trees and men swinging from them that look like me?
Twin Cities man believes that he was targeted at his workplace because of his race.
Lee Jackson says Lunda Construction hired him to work on the St. Croix Crossing project that will replace the Stillwater Bridge. But as he tells our Jennifer Merrily, after just a few months, he discovered a noose at the job site.
The Gray Cloud Casting Yard on the St. Croix River project employs roughly 80 people. Lunda Construction hired carpenter Lee Jackson.
I mean, I was excited
for the job last fall.
I mean, it was a chance for me to be financially stable.
The journeyman with 20 plus years of experience was happy to have the indoor work, something Jackson says is hard to come by.
It was a long project, lots of work, steady work, inside work, you know, comfortable work all winter.
He says he showed up on time, ready to work, but often was asked to sweep instead of use his skills. Even so, he says he couldn't have prepared for what unfolded in late January when he was asked to clean out a toolbox.
Second shelf, I pull a box out, I turn and set it down, and reach back and see a rope, pull it out, and I noticed it was a noose at the end of it. And I looked around, there's nobody around. You know, because I'm looking for somebody snickering in the corner.
He took this picture on his phone. Before he did, Jackson says he cut the end of the rope.
Instantly enraged. Then I got scared. Then I got mad. And I was, I had an attitude. I'm going to be honest with you. I had an attitude since that day, from that day. Because I don't know who put it there. I don't know why they thought they should.
He believes the rope was left for him to find, to threaten or intimidate him. In this letter obtained by WCCO, Lunda's equal employment officer acknowledges receiving the picture of the rope due to concerns that the rope was suggestive of a noose and may have a racially motivated meaning. The company did not determine who placed it in the toolbox or if it was racially motivated.
Well, it's obvious that it's an injustice.
The letter states the company would continue the investigation and would hold a mandatory meeting to review the policy against harassment and discrimination.
The meeting happened, but the topic never came up.
Lunda also offered to relocate Jackson to another project, but he chose to stay at Gray Cloud, telling WCCO he wanted to continue to work inside.
We don't use that type of rigging. There's no reason for that.
44 days after reporting the noose, Lunda Construction terminated Jackson. He admits he was given a verbal warning and was written up twice during that time frame for arguments with coworkers.
Why do you think you were terminated from the job?
I believe I was terminated from the job because I brought up, first of all, because I brought that situation to light. Second of all is because that I had an attitude about it. A lot of people told me I should have just kept my mouth shut, keep my head down, and just work.
I reached out to Lunda Construction repeatedly for a comment to the CEO and the Equal Employment Opportunity Officer. So far, no one has responded. Jackson told me he originally wanted to bring the situation to light, to start a conversation about race and rights, and to hopefully prevent his sons from having to work under similar conditions. Now, Frank, he is considering filing a formal complaint.
How long ago did you start trying to reach Lunda?
2 days ago we started. Okay. We've reached out several times.
Thank you.
Talk my Stu Scott. Excuse me on my Tupac. Keep your head up, when did you stop? Love and die. Color of your skin, color of your eyes. That's the real blues, baby, like you met Jay's, baby. You blew me away. You think more beauty in blue, green, and gray. On my Solomon up north, 12 years a slave, 12 years of age, thinking my shade too dark. I love myself, I no longer need Q-Putt. Enforcing my dark side like a young George Lucas. Light don't mean you smart, being dark don't make you stupid. A frame of mind for them busters, ain't talking woo-ha. Need a paradox for the paradox, they tutor. Like two tides, LL, you lose two times. If you don't see your beautiful in your complexion, it ain't complex to put it in context. Find the air beneath the kite, that's the context. Yeah, baby, I'm conscious, ain't no contest. If you like it, I love it, all your earth tones been blessed. Ain't no stress, jigaboos wanna be. I ain't talking J, mm-mm, I ain't talking B. I'm talking days we got school, watching movie screens. And spike your self-esteem, the new James Bond gonna be black as me. Black as brown, hazelnut, cinnamon, black tea. And it's all beautiful to me. Call your brothers magnificent, call all the sisters queens. We all on the same team, blues and pyrus, no colors ain't a thing.
This is Fresh Air, I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Toni Morrison, is one of the most celebrated writers of our time. She won a Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1988 for her novel Beloved, about a former slave looking back on her life after the Civil War. In 1993, Morrison became the first African-American woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. In 2012, President Obama awarded Morrison the nation's highest civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. This year, she won the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Book Critics Circle. Morrison, who is now 84, has a new novel that's just been published called God Help the Child. It begins with the line, "It's not my fault." Those words are spoken by an African-American woman explaining that she has no idea why she gave birth to such a dark-skinned baby. The mother is embarrassed by her daughter's darkness and wants to distance herself. The daughter is scarred by not having her mother's love. The novel is about those childhood wounds that leave a lasting mark into adulthood. Toni Morrison, welcome back to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by asking you to do a reading from your new novel. So this is from very early in the novel, where Sweetness, the mother, who is light-skinned African-American, is talking about how shocking and upsetting it was to give birth to a daughter with very dark skin. As she describes it, midnight black, Sudanese black. So would you pick up from there with the reading?
Sure. I hate to say it, but from the very beginning in the maternity ward, the baby, Lula Ann, embarrassed me. Her birth skin was pale, like all babies, even African ones, but it changed fast. I thought I was going crazy when she turned blue-black right before my eyes. I know I went crazy for a minute because once, just for a few seconds, I held a blanket over her face and pressed. But I couldn't do that, no matter how much I wished. She hadn't been born with that terrible color. I even thought of giving her away to an orphanage someplace. And I was scared to be one of those mothers who put their babies on church steps. Recently I heard about a couple in Germany, white as snow, who had a dark-skinned baby nobody could explain. Twins, I believe, one white, one colored. But I don't know if it's true. All I know is that for me, nursing her was like having a pickaninny sucking my teeth. I went to bottle feeding soon as I got home. My husband, Louis, is a porter, and when he got back off the rails, he looked at me like I was really crazy. and looked at her like she was from the planet Jupiter. He wasn't a cussing man, so when he said, "God damn, what the hell is this?" I knew we were in trouble. That's what did it. What caused the fights between me and him. It broke our marriage to pieces. We had 3 good years together. But when she was born, he blamed me and treated Lula Ann like she was a stranger. More than that, an enemy. He never touched her. I never did convince him that I ain't never, ever fooled around with another man. He was dead sure I was lying. We argued and argued till I told him her blackness must be from his own family, not mine.
That's Toni Morrison reading from her new novel, God Help the Child. So the mother distances herself from the daughter because of the daughter's dark skin. The father leaves thinking this child must not be his because he too is lighter skinned. And that sets the whole story in motion. And I'm wondering why you chose color, you know, the level of blackness as a central part of the story.
Well, I wanted to separate color from race. Distinguishing color, light, black, in between, as the marker for race is really an error. It's socially constructed, it's culturally enforced, and it has some advantages for certain people. But this is really skin privilege, the ranking of color in terms of its closeness to white people or white-skinned people and its devaluation according to how dark one is, and the impact that has on people who are dedicated to the privileges of certain levels of skin color.
So were there times in your life when you've been exposed to that kind of hierarchy of color within the African-American community?
I have. I didn't have it until I went away to college. I didn't know there was this kind of preference. But I noticed, in addition to the outside world of Washington, D.C., which at that time, this is 1949, 1950, there were very obvious stated written differences between what white people were able to do and what black people were able to do. But on the campus where I felt safe and welcome, I began to realize that this idea of the lighter, the better, and the darker, the worse, was really had an impact on sororities, on friendships, on all sorts of things. And it was stunning to me.
And you went to a traditionally African-American college, Howard University.
Yes.
So what effect did that have on you? And where did people see you? Where did people perceive you as fitting in that hierarchy of color?
I don't know. I really don't know. I had some very... I thought the whole thing was a little theatrical. None of that seemed real to me. I was an English major, we'll say, and I went into the drama department with the Howard Players because they, A, read literature differently from the way it was discussed in a class, and also the criteria for excellence had nothing to do with color. It had only to do with talent. And that was a different environment, one in which I thought, well, I did, actually. I thrived in that kind of environment.
There was a New York Times Magazine cover story about you recently. And in that article, you described When you were young, witnessing your father throw a white man down the stairs because your father thought this man was coming up the stairs after his daughters, was your father afraid that this man was coming to abuse you and your sisters?
I think he thought so. So I think his own experience in Georgia would have made him think that any white man bumbling up the stairs toward our apartment was not there for any good. And since we were little girls, he assumed that. I think he made a mistake. I mean, I really think the man was drunk. I don't think he was really trailing us. But the interesting thing was, A, the white man was, he survived. B, the real thing for me was I felt profoundly protected and defended. I was not happy because after my father threw him down the steps all the way out into the street, he threw our tricycle after him. That was a little bit of a problem since we needed our tricycle. But that made me think that there was some deviltry, something evil about white people, which is exactly what my father thought. He was very, very serious in his hatred of white people. What mitigated it was my mother, who was exactly the opposite, who never rejected or accepted anybody based on race or color or religion or any of that. Everybody was an individual whom she approved of or disapproved of based on her perception of them as individuals.
It sounds, you said that this incident made you feel protected. It sounds terrifying, though, for two reasons. One is that your father basically gave you the idea that this man was coming upstairs to do you harm. And two, watching your father not only throw him down the stairs, but throwing your tricycle down the stairs after him, it sounds like that would be a little frightening to see also.
Well, if it was you and a black man was coming up the stairs after a little white girl and the white father threw the black man down, that wouldn't disturb you.
I'm trying to think that through. I guess, you know.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, April 25th, 2015. So I have been told. Toni Morrison. You heard her close out the section of news clips. Man, oh man, the response from the white female. Wow. Now that interview went on. It was about a 44-minute interview, but that was a standing 8 count. I mean, she was totally stymied. Anywho, if folks would like to dial in, the number is 760-569. 7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. That number again is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I will get to the phone lines quickly. Only few quick things that I will add. The section on Portugal, I thought that was so important. Not that I'm surprised about how the black people are treated there. I've heard that report many, 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 many times. Too many times, in fact. But I think that it is important because too many times, I know for myself, when I first started thinking about racism, I was not thinking globally. Like, expand your thinking. With regards to racism, white supremacy, we need to vastly expand our thinking and our understanding for how all-encompassing this system is. It would be even better if all of the conversations around Freddie Gray, Michael Brown, Rekia Boyd, Miriam Carey, if they focused on, it doesn't matter if we're talking about Ferguson or Staten Island or Cleveland. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if we're talking about Oklahoma or South Carolina or Maryland, Baltimore specifically. It doesn't matter. Black people are terrorized worldwide. We could be in Portugal. We'd be having the same conversation. We had the news clip a few weeks back. We could be in Cuba. We would be having the same conversation. I almost included the sound clip. South Africa, they had a black male. He was in a car. He was unarmed. He was stopped, shot by these were plainclothes officers in South Africa. They chased him, shot him. He almost died. He lived through it. That just happened in South Africa. We would be having the exact same conversation anywhere on this planet, which is dominated, saturated by white terrorism and anti-blackness. We would be having the exact same conversation. That is very important, I think, in terms of getting a better, more accurate understanding of the world in which we live. And I think that reveals a lot. It gives a lot more weight when you start saying, well, what does it mean to be white? If this is not just something that white people in the United States do, this seems to be something that white people do worldwide. Now, what does that mean about what it means to be a white person, male, female, or child? Very important. Very important. Contrary to the one victim that you heard in that segment where he said that police brutality in London against black people was not a problem, that is not accurate. I mentioned Michael Brown Jr. He was shot and killed almost 3 years to the day of Mark Duggan. Non-white male. He does have a white parent, but generally he is identified as black. He was shot and killed by enforcement officers in London, 2011, August 2011. We did signature work on all of that. It led to what they call rioting for about a week in London and surrounding areas. We pretty much the entire month of August, we were talking about that. You can go back in the archives and get a lot more information on that. That's it. One of the other things I will just again, that the Toni Morrison segment is important for so many reasons. I got her book. I haven't read it yet. I'm looking forward to doing so. I won't even comment on the exchange that took place at the end. Just for me, it was so profound. Her talking about the sense of feeling protected that her black father valued, cherished her life, the life of his black children, and defending their black lives against a potential white terrorist. Wow. Reminds me of Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, the story Pam has at the end. Woo. Anywho, I guess I'm also supposed to mention one of my reports. I said this before, people do post content from Atlanta Black Star. I do as well, but full disclosure, I do freelance write for them just so that everybody is in the know. But they published one of my other reports this week, words we should not use when talking about racism. Some of the folks listening in helped with the editing process, but should be on Facebook, the Facebook page, Facebook groups. You can check it out. If it is constructive, you can share, leave a comment, like, get it with so that other non-white people, victims of racism, will start to think about the importance of what we say, particularly when we are addressing racism. That's it. We will get to the folks on the line. The number again, 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate, if you could allow everybody to get one opportunity to share. And then once they are done, you can, everybody has their one chance. Then if you have other things you want to share, we can make time for that as well. Everyone who has a hand up thus far, you should be with us. Feel free to chime in.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Gus and Justice, for the program today. Good evening to everyone here today. Gus, I am super appreciative of the work you do and the information you provide us. The increase of white police officers killing black people is a testament that white people have escalated their annihilation of black people. This current incident of Freddie Gray is also a testament that they have escalated their attempts to annihilate black people. And then I thought it was very informative, and also I agree with the commentary when the, I think it was a black female said that the majority of black people in the prison system there is are black, when the number, percentage of black people in the USA are not. I guess you, a small number of black people compared to the number of black people in prison. I also enjoyed the program and felt it was constructive and informative and a learning experience, the program that you had with Bob Law on racism and black music. I can see Gus having a TV network with Gus as the owner and president. Gus would have the final decision on what guests to have on the network. The network programming would run 24/7. The vision and the mission of the network would be to have constructive programming for the ultimate purpose of replacing racism, white supremacy with justice. Gus, again, I appreciate the work you do and the information you provide us. It certainly has been a learning experience for me. Can I also do the prayer this evening?
Be fine.
And this one final comment, keep in mind for all of our listeners, as I think Corman says this, white people lie to black people in all areas of people activity. Those words are music to my ears. No further comment until the prayer.
Until the prayer.
Am I being heard?
Yes, sir. Your volume is kind of loud.
Okay. I'm going to turn it down. How is it now?
It's still a little high. You could probably just use your soft voice and you'll be good.
Am I being heard at all?
Oh, yes, sir. We can hear you.
Okay, cool. The part of the news reports that caught my ear the most was when one of the first books, one of the first ones, when the white people were acting like the German propaganda against the Jewish people was so groundbreaking, so new at the time. They're saying, oh, video has only been around for 30 years or so. But when at the same time, white folks was over here doing all kind of propaganda against black people, all of the big lip watermelon eating, whatever the images that they were making, and the Birth of a Nation movie that started the whole movie industry over here. I think if the white folks were really interested in studying propaganda, then, you know, they wouldn't be trying to scapegoat Germany as the only person that did it. They would be looking at themselves. And also the Portuguese one, the fact that the cop said if it was in his power, niggas would be extinct, and that it was only a matter of time before it becomes reality. If I heard something like that, I had the power to get up out of there, being that it's in Europe and the history of killing people that they didn't like, I'd do whatever's in my power to get up out of there.
Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, any comments you all wanted to get in?
I have a comment.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be really quick. I called into your show last year. I just wanted to hear the commentary again, and I pulled up Understanding ISNIS, or I get it off of a website. But it's been a year since I've called into your show. I've been very busy. I know last time I called in, I got angry because I guess my comment didn't start with everybody else's comment, but I'm going to keep it quick. I just want to say that I'm just shocked at how white police officers are just gunning down black men. And I shouldn't be shocked. They've been doing it for a long time, but I'm saddened because we get angry and then the anger just dies down and then we go on about business as usual. And then we'll be upset for a moment and then it just goes away. But I think white people, if the same thing was happening to them, it would be a sustained anger. And I don't really sense that with black people. And last, I'm going to say this, racism has always been around. I think it's America's curse. I think it's just too much of a difference between white people and black people. I think it's almost biblical. We span the spectrum, because every other race falls in between white and black. I just think it will always be there. And I think black people need to buffer. We need to buffer ourselves against it like other races. And that's pretty much it. That's all I have to say about it. But I like what you're doing. I like your show. I like the commentary. And I think these are very important issues that we need to speak about. And that's it.
Other folks who had not shared, feel free. I am thinking, I want to make sure that other people who haven't shared get an opportunity to respond. But the question I had in my mind is, what do you mean when you say buffer? And how would a black person do that in a system of white supremacy? But I will wait before I ask to see if any of the other folks who dialed in who have not shared. Did you all have comments?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, Gus. How are you this evening? And to all the other callers and listeners, I hope you're having a great evening where you're at. Baltimore, I guess, is about ready to erupt, but, I really don't want to get into that. First thing I want to speak about, though, is I caught that comment that the Asian guy made to Bill Maher about being so demasculated that nobody wants to talk to them, like black women, nobody wants to talk to them. And I'm just like, what the? So I just wanted to point that out. It's like I heard that, and I may have heard it wrong. If I did, correct me, but I'm just like, wow. In terms of what the young lady said, I think we just, black people, we just really have to be honest. America was, you hear a lot of people talk about the foundations of what America was founded, truth, justice, all that. But racism is the foundation that they don't talk about. Because, that's just the foundation that this country was built on. In terms of the buffer, I personally think that we are the buffer between white people and every other non-black, you know, non-black, non-white people in this country. So I definitely want to hear what anybody else would have to say about your question. How do we buffer ourselves? I just think the thing that with black people is, like the report that came from Portugal, and, you know, like what you were saying, and you in your definition of racism, we have got to get to that point that this is a global system. That I mean, it's just everywhere we go. The young brother said something about the police and something about when niggers become extinct, that will be, and something like that, I guess that won't be long, you know, that won't be too long when it happens. Well, the real niggers will be extinct, and it will be the white people. You know, and so I think sometimes with the ask for it's like, you know, be careful. But it was something else I was going to say. I just think that we have to start connecting the dots. You know, just like Mr. Law talked about on your show Thursday about black the music and communication, the importance of your own media and stuff. I'm sitting up here and I'm looking at my tablet, and on Twitter, somebody just, because you know the White House Correspondents' Dinner is tonight, and they're CNN, none of these news cable networks are covering anything that's going on in Baltimore. Fox News, I think, is, you know, they're not covering the White House. They're not covering President Obama. Al Jazeera is doing something different. MSNBC and CNN are covering the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and somebody put on Twitter, said that the lady that's hosting the show on CNN says, well, we're not going to cover the Freddie Gray situation in Baltimore. They can get that information off Twitter. You know, and it's like, wow. You know, I mean, this is a cable news network, you know, basically saying, you know, we're not covering that story. You know, we're going to talk about the White House Correspondents' Dinner. This is like Hollywood on the Potomac tonight. And, you know, so, you know, 45 minutes from D.C., a city's about ready to explode, but we're not going to cover that. You can get that information on Twitter. So, like when Mr. Law talked about Thursday, the importance of communication, your own communication, TV stations, radio stations, newspapers, or what like that, so that, you know, we can say this is what's going on with us. That was something else. So, this is my last comment. Last year, I mean, 2013, you had a guest on by the name of, I can't think of his name. Anyway, it was around Thanksgiving. Nicosa Mandari, I think that's his name. And he made a statement in the interview with you, and his statement was, and it just sent fire up my spine. He said, I just want to know, when did black people, we begin to believe that white people had changed? And what he said was, the basic same attitude that we're looking at white people today, the same thing that was in these people 1600, 1500, 1700, the same basic attitude, how they feel about us as black people. And we have to come out of this thing that look at white people. I'm not saying that they're not good white people, but I remember you said, Dr. Cambon said, the numbers are so small, it's negligible. They can't help us anyway. You know, looking for good white people, believing somewhere, we as black people believe in our mind that these people, they're going to change. They're just going to wake up one day and realize the error of their ways, and they're going to change. And that's not going to happen. It's just a lot of stuff. Like you say, racism and white supremacy is a problem. But we have to be the one to change it. We cannot sit back and expect them to do something. Dr. Wilson said, that's like mental illness, you know, because we want to forgive them. Oh, they don't know what they're doing. Da 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 da. So we want to forgive them. And we got to be the one to change that. I think that we are the buffer. I don't know how we can do that. And I'll mute myself. Thank you.
Other folks who have not shared have comments they wanted to get in.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello, everyone. I just wanted to say something really quickly. I've been, you know, kind of busy and listening to the archives a lot. I did get to hear yesterday's program of Malcolm X, and there's two things that really struck me. That intro that Gus did with the speech where Malcolm X is talking about the murder of a young person in New York, and that he had gotten, sources had told him that that it was done to try to spark riots. And so, which, kind of brought me back to today with, the odd thing they did in Ferguson by releasing that grand jury report, in the middle of the night. I said, well, that clearly they were trying to spark riots. And the reason they wanted to spark riots so they have an excuse for killing even more people. And so I'm wondering if that's what they're up to right now. And then the other thing that really struck me was that that Brother Malcolm said that what he wanted to do was unify black people, and that rather than having white people join them, is that they work with each other. So get other white people to accept and admit that, yes, they're practicing racism, white on white, to get them to stop it. And then, we teach each other about, what's going on, and then we change our behavior. So those are the two things that I got out of it. And I think these are things that Gus has been saying for a long time, but, being dense and definitely a victim, it's just taking me a while to really understand. But I appreciate that you keep trying. So I will mute my line. Thank you.
Can I be heard? Hello?
Yes, ma'am. We can hear you.
Okay. Thanks. Greetings to everyone on the line. I wanted to tie into what the previous caller just said about these things being used as an excuse to kill more black people. And I wanted to tie that with the piece that you played about the propaganda in the Holocaust. When I first started kind of getting into studying racism and white supremacy, that was one of the first things I did, was kind of look at the images that they were posting about the so-called Jewish people in Nazi Germany, and that was one of the first things that I connected that. So I was like, that's basically what's going on now, and I do believe that these like constant focus all of a sudden in why, or in these instances where these black men or black males are being shot down in the street. And I was thinking on how, I look at that as a black female, and I'm related to that person, but I've been thinking more and more on, as someone, what would a white female or a white male look at that and see? And that's exactly what I've come to the conclusion is, it's basically giving them fuel. Your so-called everyday white person is giving them fuel to be like, well, yeah, these black people deserve to be shot down the street. Look at them. They go out in the street and so-called protest, but they destroy property and whatever, whatever. And it kind of reinforces the idea that they have of us, that we kind of deserve to be shot down the street. And thinking on that, it's, now in the piece that said that they were giving away radios and giving away all of these mediums to get the propaganda, and now I feel like we've kind of, it's like that, but it's like on crack or steroids, because now we feed into that propaganda ourselves unknowingly, I think, because we feel like that's the only way we can get our voices heard. But at the same time, it is kind of contributing to the overall like idea of trying to dehumanize us and denigrate black people. So I have to agree. I think it's an excuse to kill more black people, and it will be used. It's another tool out of their toolbox. So that's all I wanted to speak on. I'll mute my line.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Other folks with us who have not shared have other comments they wanted to get in. I am glad that the female caller that mentioned the segment from Bill Maher, where the non-white male, so-called Asian male, who said that Asian males are emasculated and he felt that he had been treated like a black female. I thought that that was worthy of a thought or two as well. I'm glad that came up. But anybody else who we have not heard from yet have comments they want to get in?
I didn't respond to my first statement.
I will get your response. I just want to make sure we didn't miss out on anybody who hasn't been able to comment at all. But I'll get your comment. Anybody that we missed so far hasn't been able to share?
Good evening, everyone. Can I be heard clearly?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, my phone's cutting out. I was listening to the archives, and it was Mr. Bouchon.
Bouchon, yes.
Yes, and he was talking about the sundown towns. And he eventually came to the conclusion that it was unnatural for us to be segregated as humans. And I think he may have gotten that backwards, because I think what he was seeing in those white people was like feral white people. He said these were white people who had never been around black people. And it is my contention that white people who are not around black people are not exposed to civility and humanity. They're feral, you know, like the cats and stuff. And the anger and hostility they have is like that hissing. It's just a protective mechanism because you've never been around humans before. I think I said it before, but occasionally when I practice looking at white people and just looking at their skin, I freak out. And it sounds like he was caught off guard because he said the same thing. He was saying words like it was terrible. He said it was the most crazy emotional thing that's ever happened. He said that it was so scary and it was unnatural. And I am telling you that white people who have not been around black people, the only reason they fool us all the time is because they're around black people. They mimic everything. And if we would just pay attention to the fact that they are white, I mean, if you just really look at them, it will freak you out. But you have to stop falling. You just look at them. Just look at the skin. Stop listening to their voice or their faces or their fake tears or all that makeup on their face so they don't look like they, so they look like they have color. Just look at their skin. It will freak you out, and it will stop you from getting around those people. It will stop you immediately. You will be disgusted, and you will just be, you will be so uncomfortable when you see white people as they really are. It's just, you have to practice, though. And that is it.
Other folks with us who have not shared, who have a hand up.
Oh. Can I be heard? Yeah.
Yes, sir, we can hear you.
How you doing? Thomas Smith from New York. The last caller who just spoke, you know, she mentioned that before on the show, just look at them, and I have. And man, she's right. Something strange about them, you know, and I've noticed that it's different types of them. Some of them are pink, some of them are yellow, some of them are white, and I'm noticing the ones that's real pinkish red, they're really loud mouths. They really go in, and the yellow ones are a little bit more reserved. The pale ones are sneaky. I mean, it's just real strange. Thank you for pointing that out, because, you know, I never really paid attention before. And even their acting looks funny. I mean, it's like, ugh. I had a few comments. I was walking, sorry. Bill Mayer, it seemed like he got offended when the Asian guy started making jokes about the Jews. I don't know if you picked that up, but he's like, wait a minute there, you know, explain that. You know, it's like he almost got offended. The Germans learned all their tactics from the American eugenics. Like they said, movies. And what I would love to know is how come we always prop up German things? Like, it's like the excellence of the German, whatever they make. And a lot of stuff is made here first, like the car. I thought Ford invented that. I mean, it's just strange how they always prop German things up. Even better than their own thing. It's just very, you know, they'll never do that for black people, you know. And that's my last comment. I'll wait for work please.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Interesting music. I wanted to comment about what Karma said. I find that a lot of times that we don't pay attention. And I mean that in every sense of the word. We don't stop and look at what we're doing, what we're seeing. Excuse me, one of us, so you may hear something. But we don't pay attention. And I find that not just in regards to racism and white supremacy, but in everyday life, we don't seem to pay attention. And that makes us dysfunctional. And I think that's by design. But when we actually do pay attention and look at white people, it is kind of freaky. It is kind of scary. And I also have a workplace comment that I want to share. But we need to pay attention, and not just with our actions and words, but our environment. And we just, you know, that needs to be in the forefront of my mind of paying attention, being aware of everything. And I'll mute my mind.
Maddie Heard?
Yes, you can be heard.
I just want to say, in regards to the, I think it was maybe 3 calls ago, the young woman who talked about some of the technical rationale that people in the system of white people in the system of race and white supremacy give for their abuses of black people. Be not fooled by that. Be not fooled. White people have always tried to provide some sort of technical rationale for why they abuse you. Just know that they are abusers by nature. That's all you got to know. It does not matter. They've tried to do that for centuries. They come with everything, the width of your nose, the darkness of your skin, your physiological makeup. You're not acting right. You're not smart enough. It's always been something. It doesn't matter what they do. The focus should be more so on how you as an individual make sure that you don't allow any of that to stick to you, especially if it's nonsense, you know, mostly. So, you know, they've done a very good job sociologically at this point, making sure that, the environment totally, as Paul Mooney would say, you know, this is built to just wear us out. You know, it just wears you down over time. And a lot of black people are suffering psychologically. You know, psychopathologies are abundant. So, you know, that's one of the things. Just being healthy psychologically is where you should really focus your energies. But they're always going to try to make something stick just so it's their technical rationale for why they abuse you. But just know that they're just abusers. That's all you got to know.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings. My thoughts, for some reason, has been on, and to the listeners, if you have been hearing lately, there's been several articles, reports on people activity of sex with, I believe it's white people, any the range is from children to adults. One was Bruce Jenner, who had been making this decision to go from male to female. In the child's case, the child acts to make this change to the parents as though they're asking to go to the park or something. It, and I'm just wondering on how that this sick behavior that white people have probably been doing since day one of their existence, how that is going to basically affect us, because normally just about everything, every habit, bad habit especially, that white people carry out, we end up being either affected by it or in some cases even mimic our oppressors in that way. And I mean, I know it's been around for a long time, but I just recently have just been hearing some reports this week, a lot of reports this week on that subject matter of several cases, and I always recognize nothing is done by accident. And, you know, just kind of like paying attention to it a little bit.
I agree with you, because we always try to embellish on it, and it's scary.
And what's dangerous about it is not so much about someone who is Mr. Jenner's age, but like a five-year-old, a 5 or 6-year-old non-white child, male or female, that can be very problematic, being that a lot of non-white people are confused no matter what their age is. The sexual subject is confusing to people when they're children anyway, especially at those young ages. And with this purpose sexual confusion that goes about, it can really complicate that situation for us even more. And at the same time, sex in general is almost like a religion that exists. And so all of those things have been, you know, lately, this week, been on my mind from seeing these articles and these news reports. Thank you for listening.
May I be heard?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Good evening, Gus, and to the listeners. I wanted to make a comment about the passage that Toni Morrison was reading from her book. I had a question. What was the name of that book? I didn't catch it, and I was wondering if that's something that could be put on the list for us to read. It sounded interesting. When she was talking about the color of the baby being dark and the deep-rooted self-hatred that, you know, a lot of us have, it reminded me of my grandmother. Every time there's like a baby born in our family, she rushes to see the baby's ears and trying to see how dark the baby is. And she's, you know, just someone in our family who has been so, you know, concerned about how dark our, you know, our family, who's the darkest, and she puts, you know, preference over the lighter skin in our family. So when I heard that passage, it really just kind of, you know, really intrigued me because it was something I'm kind of familiar with. And I was just wondering if you got the title, because I, if you could repeat the title, because I missed it.
God Help the Child is the title. I said on the book study group yesterday, we have one more session left for Minister Malcolm's autobiography, and then we'll be done. And I'm trying to decide whether or not to do Assata Shakur's autobiography or God Help the Child. I'm still on the fence for the moment, but hopefully I will make up my mind within the next day or two and keep it moving. But yeah, I'm also interested in checking that out as well. And I think all of us, I think that's part of the appeal of the book. It reminded me a lot of The Bluest Eye. That's what the system of white supremacy does. I think that came up yesterday in the book study session about the emphasis on Minister Malcolm being Detroit Red and having reddish hair and his complexion and all of that due to the rape in his matrilineal line. But yeah, that's what the system of white supremacy conditions, contaminates us to behave in that manner, to be obsessive and all of that, not wanting to get in the sun, not wanting to get too dark, don't marry. I mean, all of that is a response to the system of white supremacy. So it's, I'm interested to check the book out myself.
Oh, and I also wanted to, I just received that book, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. And that passage, oh my goodness, it reminded me of that, I can't remember the part that you played, but I was just reading the story right at the beginning of the book. And I remember, heard you correlate that part that you played of the father, or the father protecting, or the protection of the black woman, and how they, you know, it's yearned and needed. And when I was reading that part of the book, I was like, wow, I was just reading this. So it was interesting just that you played that, and it made me reflect on the book. So I'm very interested in reading this and finishing this up also.
Reading is more important than watching television.
Hey, Gus, how did that end? Because my line went mute just as she was answering the lady, Toni Morrison. What was her answer? She told the white lady, well, if this was a white, your white father coming up the stairs to protect you, you wouldn't feel that way. And the white lady was like, I have to think about that. And then my line went completely dead until you said context of white supremacy.
Oh, that was the end of it.
That was the end of it. Okay.
If you want to go to NPR to hear, it's like a 45-minute interview. So you got to hear maybe about 10 minutes of it. But that was there. She stumbled. It was like she, like it was a standing eight count. Like she could not get her response together. It took her a while to then be like, well, no, I don't think that was it, and blah, blah, blah. And they went on with the interview. But I thought it was fascinating all the way around that Toni Morrison just bow. And I think she was accurate. I think that was a huge part of why she had some difficulty to that, why she opposed that. She didn't have that sense of, oh, that is great, having a black father defending his black family. That's never something that white people are going to celebrate and endorse. It was immediately, this is incorrect. That nigga is not supposed to be putting his hands on a white person, like at any point on this planet, at any time. I thought that was incredible, but she stumbled a couple times before she could get her response out. I did that on purpose. Did we miss anybody? Anybody have a hand up who hasn't been able to comment? Anybody missed? Checking. Oh.
So, before we move on to racism in the workplace, can I make another comment?
Are we sure we didn't miss anybody? Anybody with us who hasn't commented?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. there was a few things I had discovered this week. If I could share this experience, my mom and my aunt's birthday was 2 days ago, and we went out to eat. And I know just talked about, you know, celebrations and things like that, but I found it constructive to spend time with the family, you know, a black family. But it's been something I've been thinking about, you know, the term that was used by a suspected race soldier or suspected racist waiter who approached our table, because there was at least about 10 to 12 of us. And, you know, I've been thinking about this. He said, well, man, I noticed that y'all sitting back here in the dark. I said, I would think that y'all was hiding like ninjas. Now, you know, the place was well lit, you know, but the other people who I was there with, they didn't seem to understand what he was saying. So, you know, I guess, you know, their response was just regular, you know, they probably just laughed or whatever. But I'm like, he said ninjas and dark, you know. But, you know, I just found that kind of odd. I think he was exhibiting white supremacy. And, yeah, you know, that's been on my mind. And, but I don't really talk to my relatives about that topic, because I don't think they understand it on that level, you know, when terms are used. So, yeah, that's one thing I was thinking about. The second, there was a story about some black students. They were approached by a white woman, and she took their flag or something like that. And, you know, the black female said, you know, this is not yours. You know, and she was like, oh, actually it is. Actually it is. It's the whole United States. And I'm like, wow, she just went up and took their flag like it was nothing. And she appeared to be shocked to be arrested. But it took so long to arrest and apprehend this woman. And it's like four or five cops surrounding her. They still, one of the white guys still ended up yelling at the black students, like, back up, back up. So a couple of days later, apparently, one of the black males that was in that group, it was an article saying that they had a warrant out for his arrest, because I guess they thought he had some weapons or something like that. But someone posted on Facebook that apparently somebody from the KKK, I guess, you know, set him up or something. But that's vaguely what I heard. And last but not least, there was another article about a taxi cab dispatcher, and he was getting calls from black patrons or black customers. A white person outed him, another white woman, you know, outed another racist, you know. And there was video footage of how he was talking when no black people was around. So after he hang up the phone, he would say, effing niggers. So the white guy approaches him, the reporter, and he says, there's been allegations that you have been speaking in a rude way about black students here, or university students. And he says, no, I didn't do that. And he says, well, from what I've researched, that may be true or something. And he says, what? No, that is not true. And then he said, I have it on videotape. So this guy stands out of his seat, stands up from his seat. And he says, let me see that. And within like in 5 seconds, he just tells everybody to get out. So he just lied right there on the spot, you know, about practicing racism. So I found that interesting. And they said he was suspended by his parents because he's a part of the family that owns or runs the taxi service, or pretty much everything.
Wow.
White people lie.
All the time. All the time. I just wanted to comment real quick. I definitely don't have a problem at all. If you have constructive contact with family members, attempted family members, or quote unquote friends that are black people, that is fantastic. Y'all can hang out and have constructive dialogue, and that's good to replenish from all the toxins we experience from white supremacy. That is a plus. Take advantage. What I was thinking you were going to raise was that, you know, you've heard on this program about eating out. That was the only concern that I had. Not, you know, the birthday celebrations per se. The eating out, because there have been so many studies, and that's just one thing that I've said from an economic counter-racist perspective and just from trying to avoid terrorism. There's so many reports about how white people practice racism in the restaurant industry. That's a whole like section in the book Two-Faced Racism, which is on my top 10. When he called, said that you all were hiding like ninjas. I know we talked about it on the program before. Ninjas is a code word for niggers. Like, this is right. Online. So when I heard that, I was just like, wow, like that's just like him calling a whole table of black people niggers. And then this is the person that's responsible for bringing me anything, like a glass of water, an ice cube, a napkin, anything like that. I'm going to, you know, like that's the way that I think we should think about it in terms of really trying to minimize. I know for some people, if you travel a lot, you're on the go, it can be difficult, but I mean, really trying to minimize that eating out, just as I said, from a counter-racist economic perspective in terms of not trying to fund racists. And from a, well, let me minimize the number of opportunities that I give an enemy of mine to give me something to put in my mouth, just from that perspective, if that makes sense at all.
That makes excellent sense. Thank you for that, sir.
Did we miss anybody? You got everybody? The female caller at 1689, did you want to respond? You were the one about buffering and the...
Yeah, I do want to respond to that, but I've heard so many comments that really quickly what this guy said, my roommate is Hispanic and she's from El Salvador. I have to talk a little bit low. I hope you guys can hear me. But she works in a restaurant. She won't tell me where. I'm in Dallas, Texas. But her boss is a white man. And he confided, she's been there for years, he confided in her, he will not hire blacks. And when blacks come to the restaurant, no one wants to serve them. And, you know, my thing is, I get up in a minute and walk out of an establishment. It doesn't make me none. It's plenty of people out there that cook hamburgers or whatever that restaurant was cooking, shrimp or whatever. And a lot of them would be happy to take my money. But, yeah, I do want to make a comment about what I said about buffering. When I said buffering, that I think black people should buffer themselves, racism is one of those things that just won't go away. It's been there forever, it seems like. I think we need to start becoming more self-supportive in our own neighborhoods, meaning supporting black-owned businesses, breaking ourselves away from having to interact with whites. I think a lot of what drives our interaction with whites, the black males, is poverty and despair. These white men come into black communities and they become predators. And I just think, you know, I think that integration did a lot of damage to us. And I'm not an advocate for separation, but I just think integration was not good. But I think if we just became kind of like the immigrant community, if you look at most of the immigrant communities, they're self-supporting and, you know, they're close-knit. And they lessen their interactions with whites. They do. I think it would help us if we just was not so vulnerable, because we're forced to interact more with them because of our poverty. And that's basically, you know, what I was saying. That's just what I think. But you know, let me just make this one comment. And this is controversial, and I know that everybody's going to hate me for this. When we're talking about white supremacy, a portion, what was going through my head during half this conversation, I talk to my mother a lot, and we talk about this whole thing with black men being killed and white supremacy, but we have to, and I've come to the conclusion, I'm 37 years old, I've come to the conclusion in my life that when they were bringing the Africans over from Africa to the United States, they had some Africans on those boats that had really defective genes. And not all black people have defective genes. A lot of us are smart, industrious, but we have to admit, if you look at our communities, if you look at our countries, that so, if you look at the fact that we're having all these problems, that there is a segment of black people that are defective, you know, and I'm sitting, white people know it, and I'm telling you,
ma'am,
they know it.
Ma'am,
they know it.
Thank you for the commentary. That did feel pretty anti-black, but
no,
I will just hang on a second. Hang on a second, because we did have somebody else who wanted to comment. I'm just saying, to me, it felt very anti-black. I will just say again, if you don't understand racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works, everything else that you do understand will only confuse you. The words of Mr. Neely Fuller Jr. You should check out his books, The Word Guide, Code Book, ProduceJustice.com. The male caller who's doing the prayer, you said you had one more comment you wanted to get in.
Yeah, I was just going to say black people's problems are white people, and that problem is racism, white supremacy. Now, racism, white supremacy is terrorism and war against black people by white people. And in my opinion, the solution to racism, white supremacy is justice. And part of that solution is that we as black people separate ourselves from white people and to only interact with white people for business necessity. The solution is for black people to do constructive things designed to replace the system of racism, white supremacy with justice. And justice is guaranteeing that no black person is mistreated and guaranteeing that the black person that needs help the most gets the most constructive help. And I, again, believe that the solution to racism, white supremacy, is going to be for us to separate from white people. There has been no evidence that this is or is not a solution, but it's a constructive action plan because we are still in the system of racism, white supremacy.
We have about 60 seconds before we get to workplace racism. Anybody else have final comment before we get to workplace racism?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
The one thing I just want to say is about the defective. I 60 seconds wouldn't hear you. It's not that black people were defective, it's kind of like the colleague just said. Our problem is white people. Our defects that we may have come from the things that white people have done to us. We are people who are, unfortunately, we're depressed, suppressed, oppressed, repressed. And because, you know, the lack of things that we have, and, you know, the hyper-individualism, which has really been bred into us, you know, because we don't have the semblance of unity, you know, for us to stay. And I mean, I'm hoping that as stuff go on, that we will find things to unify around to fight this. But in terms of the defect, it's not that say we were inherently, you know, some of us created defects. I mean, all of us are created with different things. But what goes on with us is definitely the mark of white supremacy.
I think we give white people too much credit. All right.
Anywho, we're going to workplace racism. Workplace racism. Before I get to workplace racism, one of our listeners wrote in, and I guess ongoing, just make sure we're codified about this. If you would like to see if there are other people who listen to the program who are in your particular area and you want to have contact with them, you know, meet up, have a coffee, discuss constructive ideas and what have you, just if you drop me an email, untiljustice@gmail.com, just make sure you put in the subject, the geographic location. So it would be Los Angeles contact, Miami contact, London contact. Just make sure that that's the way that the subject reads. It needs to be specific. That makes it easier for me to locate and, you know, forward emails efficiently. So just make sure that's the subject, your geographic location, Miami contact, Texas contact, whatever. And I will pass that info along. Seems like folks are interested in doing that. We have one other listener who wrote in, and he says he recently began the conceptual process for a documentary on racism. The working title is Ma'afa Decoded, Racism, a Documentary Explanation. The idea started as a book concept, evolving as I began delving deeper into studying racism. The documentary will look at the evolving etymological, legal, and cultural views of racism in America and Britain, though I envision Britain being featured briefly as the foundational contributor to America's racist attitudes. The documentary's climax will be the connection of those old elements to today. As stated earlier, I am in the conceptual phase of the documentary, where structure is a bit more fluid, so the topic will become more focused as the process plays out. If folks are interested in participating in the research for the project, you can let me know. Same process, email. Just put in a documentary for the subject, and I will forward your contact information along. But that's an opportunity. We say all the time about the importance of not having spectators. There you go. Opportunity if you'd like to work on a documentary project on racism. With that, workplace racism, if folks would like to participate, the number is 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press *6 if you would like to participate. I thought it was telling the segment in the news clips where the black male found the noose on his job, and he talked about how angry it made him. He went from being afraid to being angry, and that within 44 days, they had terminated him and writing him up for getting in arguments with other white. I think that is exactly a part of the design, particularly on the jobs, to get us frustrated, angry, really out of control and emotional, not thinking about the best, the most logical way of dealing with a problem. And then once they get us upset and responding that way, they just go about piling up paperwork on us so that they can justify terminating us. It's standard operating procedure, in my opinion. Folks have comments on workplace racism?
I have a comment.
You're breaking up a little bit. Go ahead.
My comment is this. Hold on, let me get your speaker. Okay, my comment is this. I've also dealt with workplace racism. I live in Dallas, as I said, but I used to live in Memphis. I've dealt with workplace racism, and what it has taught me, and everybody's not so fortunate. I don't have any children, but when I saw how dirty these white people were and how much stress they would put people under and the dirty, devious stuff they would do to people, I stayed away from debt. And I'm going to tell you why I did that. I don't have a car now. I don't have a credit card. My rent's cheap. I did that because I have had to walk off jobs. And I had a conversation with my mother once. And we both agreed, you know, if I'm in a very stressful situation like that, I can't tell you how many jobs I've walked off of that. Now, that's not for everyone because some people have families, but it's one of the things, it's one of the reasons that I've stayed away from getting in debt until I could start my own business. And I just wish that more African Americans would, you know, get into their own business because we can't trust, you know, in the South especially, we can't trust working in these businesses. It's too much mistreatment.
Maybe we'll do female first.
Okay. Thank you, and I'll try to make this quick. I'm asking for some help tonight with, you know, with my situation. And as I tell you the story, just listen. I may even have done some things wrong, so I just need your help. I don't have much dealings with white females, so this involves a white female. And it's been a long time, though. I mean, because, you know, when I first got out of college, you know, but then it cut them over like a 20-year span that most of the jobs that I was working at, where I was living at, I was really working more around white black people, you know. So my dealings with white females, you know, have been sparse, shall we say. And so, okay, let me talk to you about this job real quick. On the job that I work at, now we're temps. The job that I work at is the insurance company. And we were doing the process. It was called pricing. And that is like if our insurer, say, hit some furniture on your property, we would have to be, you know, liable for that. And you would say that. You would send me your loss list. Oh, they ran into our deck. We had chairs on the deck. We had flowers on the deck. Our children's bikes were on the deck. And then they would send in the list, and we had to price that so that we can pay the claim, you know. And so we were doing that, and then they taught us a process called BDs. And I explained it to you. And when we do BDs, we just basically we're settling claims. That's the, you know, and up to a certain price point, I can settle. Then when we go high, a little higher, there are things I can do to review the file, then we have to send it on. So the pricing part was like we were getting these lawsuits from all over the country. And so we were doing that. Well, eventually they took that away from us, and that left us doing BDs. So what happened was we also have in-house adjusters who do pricing. So what they did was they took the adjusters, they do the whole thing, pricing included. They even do BDs. You know, they do it, they price the stuff, they settle, they do the BDs to settle the claim, blah, 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 blah. So what they did was one day I came to work. My manager, she called me over and she said, you know, we're trying to do something, Kim. And she said, so we want you to do this. I said, okay, sure, no problem. And it was like pricing for in-house adjusters. So, you know, I was over there, you know, doing it. And on my computer, that would come up. The other things that I did, you know, just didn't come up. That would come up. Well, one day she walked by my desk. And you know how you sit in the office and you know, you can walk by people's desk and you can see what's on their computer. So she walked by going out, and then the way we sit, she sits like, it's like the end of the wall. It's like a dead end. So she's at the dead end. And so then she comes back to her desk, and then she comes, go back out, and I was sitting there doing stuff. So she comes by my desk and she says, oh, you're doing pricing. And I said, well, yeah. And she proceeded to like ask questions. So, you know, I'm just like working. You know, it's kind of like, okay, you need to talk to, you know, our manager about it. I'm just doing what I was told to do. So, you know, one day, going out for lunch and just talking about some things. And I let my guard down, and I was just talking about some of the frustrations that I had. And then I heard her say, hey, you know, because I called our manager, and I was telling him that, you know, she's doing pricing. And, you know, I'm saying to myself, uh-oh, you know, uh-oh. So just let it go. Get back to my desk, come back to work. Then one day, she bothers me about a mirror. And as I had, my guard was just really down. I'm looking at my mirror, you know, for my person. I'm like, no, I left my makeup bag at home. You know, so she goes back and sits down. And so then that's kind of like, I'm like, wait a minute. Now, you bugging me about a mirror. If I don't have a mirror, you go back to your desk and sit down and go back to work. So you didn't need a mirror. You know, I'm saying to myself. And so, it just really seems to be that, you know, it's just, you know, just bothering me at this time. So I'm like, man. So then one day they finally take us upstairs. They say everybody's going to be doing the same thing that I'm doing. So then the other day, my manager come on, and in part of this job, you have to make phone calls. But what we were doing, we didn't have to make calls. But my manager, she told us, she said, eventually you may have to start making calls. So what happened was Friday, she comes over and she sits up there, and it's not a personal meeting because she's like sitting right, you know, across, leaning up on the desk across from where I'm sitting at. And do you know this woman? She turns around and just sits up and listens to the whole conversation. You know, and I mean, even though it wasn't a private conversation, it was just like, well, she's not talking to you, you know. And basically what she was telling me now, she said, now, Kim, you're going to have to call and get the list. So basically, I was like the guinea pig. We're going to use you to see how this works. And then we're going to, I guess, you know, spread it out. So I kept thinking about it because she just really getting on my nerves. And I'm like, Annie, I'm like, these white women. And, you know, and I'm trying to keep myself from snapping, you know. like the young sister was saying, of course I have debt, so I need my job, you know. And I stood up here and I said, you know, what is, and I just really think that she was just really upset because I was the one asked to do this. Now, I didn't, you know, it wasn't anything I do. I work like everybody else. You know, if people pull people out to do something, then evidently you would either talk with somebody and somebody felt that you probably was a good person to try this with, you know. And so, I don't know. I'm just asking for some help because, like I say, me working with white and from the time I got on my own, I always had problems with white women. But like I said, then I went for like a 20-year span, 20, 25-year span, for the most part, not really having to deal with them. Now, I don't know. Maybe I'm being anxious about nothing, but can anybody give me any kind of advice to help me to deal with this woman? Or maybe it could be me. So I'm just looking for some advice.
You know, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Can I speak? Okay. This is what I would do if I was you. I would try to outthink them because they're always trying to outthink us. What I would do was keep a log of all of my interactions, the date, the time, and if you think it's racial, this is what you do. Go to the, file a complaint with the EEOC, even if you think it's just a little bit racial. The reason you do that is because if they ever come back and fire you or try to terminate you, it becomes retaliation. You understand? Because once you, after you file that complaint, you know, then if the company makes any, because EEOC will, you know, if they make any move against you. And I just found that out from my various experiences watching people, what they do. A lot of people try to hold up and don't go to the EEOC and file, you know, and the company fires them anyway. But if she's acting like that with you, I wouldn't put nothing past her. And, you know, like I said, I'll keep a record because EEOC needs to see date and time and everything. Because, you know, nobody should have to go through that on the job. Nobody. Mm-hmm. I have a very short temper. I don't ever go off and fly off the handle. I'm very professional. My thing is I just walk out of the job. I quit a job because it was a beautiful day. So I'm looking for another one tomorrow. I just want to go on a picnic. I actually did that before. But it's not something I'm proud of. But I don't really have any debt. I don't have any children. And I could pay I have enough money saved where I could go a year and not have to worry about a job, you know, because I'm just a religious saver like that. My bills are so little. But that's my advice to you. It's just, okay. That's what I would do.
Thank you. Anybody else?
May I be heard?
Yes.
Okay. I just want to piggyback off of what the caller said who talked about the debt. I totally agree with you about the debt because one of the white people's strategy to practice racism, white supremacy against black people is to keep them in debt. They want us to buy more house than we can afford, buy more car than we can afford, buy more material things that we can afford, be in credit card debt up to depression. And when they know that we are in that position, that is one of their strategies that they can amp up their practices to practice racism, white supremacy against us. I, too, have a mantra that I use for myself. When I get ready to buy anything, I always ask myself, is it a want or is it a need? And if it's a want, I don't buy it. I, too, am a very firm person in staying out of debt. I always pay myself first before I pay anybody else because I want to be able to, when I get to the point where I can't take it anymore, to leave the plantation and not be under any stress that I got a mortgage to pay, I got a car note to pay, I got material things to pay, I got a credit card debt to pay. Those are the things that white people, once they know those things about you, they feel like they have their foot on your neck and you're not going anywhere. But to take the
terrorism that we are mm-hmm. subjecting you to, and there's mm-hmm. nothing you can do about it. So I agree with you, and I encourage all of our listeners here today, when you decide to buy something, and if you're in that kind of debt, ask yourself, is it a want and or is it a need? And if it's a want, do not buy it, because they have a paramount amount of strategies that they use against us to practice racism, white supremacy, and debt is one of them.
Just want to make sure we go back, because we did have a listener who asked for help in dealing with this situation. If I'm understanding it correctly, you were doing an assignment that was different from what some of the other people in your department were doing.
Basically. Right, correct.
Okay, and seeming mm-hmm. like you were performing your job well, it seems. And
yeah.
this other white woman, suspected race soldier, seems like she might have had a problem with that, been jealous about that, and going to talk to your supervisor, manager, whoever the person is, about, oh, she's not doing the same thing as everybody else, and, you know, maybe we should get everybody on the same page. Is that kind of the gist of...
Right, and keep in mind now, because we're all temps.
Right.
And so we all work for the same manager that she... Cause, and keep in mind, our manager, the one, you know, is not in the area that we're in. He's in another state.
Okay.
So, you know, she called, and like I say, in the course of us one day, and like I said, this might be on me, because, you know, going up to get something to eat, and I did let my guard down, and I was just talking about some of the frustrations I was having, you know, just like the... sometimes nice in general, and then she started talking, and then that's when I heard her. She says, oh, because I talked to him, and I was like, you know, she, you know, they said pricing was gone, but she's pricing, and that's when I'm like, uh-oh. I'm like, okay, Kim, you know. So you are correct with that.
Wow. That chatting, like, that's something that we pointed out many times mm-hmm. on the program, that, you know, white people network all the time, and particularly in workplace settings. Mm-hmm. They have all kind. I mean, you talk about, what do white people talk about when it's no black people on the around? Man, on the job, that is going down hard, where they are having all kinds of conversations about you and what you're doing on the job, things, who are you sleeping with, anything. Did you get a new car? Where are you going on vacation? What's on your Facebook? That's what I mean. You really, you just kind of have to have that in mind in terms of the way you function on the job at all times, that this is total war. And any information that they get about you is going to be exchanged, and how can we use this against you? So just kind of having that in the forefront of your mind, not being surprised about that. And then, yeah, I mean, it didn't seem like, even though you found out she was doing all of these things, which is, I mean, that's practicing racism, but it didn't seem like any problems came out. It just seems like being frustrated with her conducting herself. Okay. That's just, white people are treacherous. It's kind of like you just have to be in the mind state of, that's what I'm dealing, and to be thankful that you're not confused about that, so that you're very clear in what you're dealing with every single day that you go on the job, and making sure that you have that war mentality. And it's not saying that, you know, you give an ugly face to everybody and don't speak. Not saying that at all. Mm-hmm. You want to make sure that you know, keep your source of income, but making sure that your conduct is reflective of the fact that I'm not working. These are not my friends. These people are not cool with me. These are people that would try to get me fired at the drop of a dime.
Mm-hmm.
They're very devious, very dirty.
And you have to keep that thought in your conscious mind 24/7 when you're at work, because otherwise you will let your guards down, thinking that they are some good white people. And just when you have let your guard down, that's when they will remind you how wickedly wise they are and terroristic they are. And you will wonder what happened. So, and I know for a lot of us, it's hard to think like that, because we want to be accepted and included in everything that white people do. But white people are wickedly wise. And the moment you let your guard down is when they get you.
My mother told me, can I say something? Mm-hmm. My mother told me about in Jackson, Mississippi, she knew a man who, a black man, who had worked at this car company, finance company. It was a new car dealership for many, many years. He started off as a seller, and he moved up and became a finance manager. And he worked with a lot of white men. No one ever knew how nice he lived. One Christmas, he decided to have a Christmas party. Oh. And he invited the people he worked with out to his house. And these were mostly white males with their wives. This was in, like I said, Jackson, Mississippi. They came out to the man's house, and the man had been real wise. He had saved a lot of his money. He had invested some of it, and he had grown it. He had purchased his big house, and he had decked it out, and he had, you know, two or three really nice cars in the yard. And he was living better than half the white men he worked with. They came there to his house. Their wives were looking around, shocked that this man could be living so good. He had worked at that dealership for 13 years. After that Christmas party, my mother told me, 2 weeks later, he was fired. And so, like I said, you can never put anything past them. Never. Ever.
Do we have anybody else who had comments they wanted to get in? Workplace racism? Anybody we hadn't heard from?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Let's get the female first. Female caller, are you with us?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. This is a kind of an advice-seeking statement as well. I live in an area of America that recently has received a lot of attention for various things, rape and such. And back in September, I guess, I was a little less, a lot less codified at work. And I'm kind of young, so this is kind of my first job with adult people. So I was really unprepared for it. And I was kind of going around making my opinions be known. And I was speaking with a white male, and we were talking about this case that received national attention late last year of a black male accused of murdering a white female. And they caught him, and we were talking, and I was like, you know, it's just, and this was before I had any real opinion of what white people do, what they say, anything. I was still kind of just like, oh my gosh, this is wrong, and wanting to talk to other people about it and get their stance. And we were speaking on it, and he was like, well, what do you think about the case? And I was like, you know, it's really weird. They just say DNA evidence. They're not really being specific about what they have against him. And it doesn't really quite matter what I feel now because they caught him. And I was not at all coming across like I had any particular issue with white people. But he came to the conclusion that, and he said this, he's like, you sound just full of hatred. And I let it go, and I was like, well, I didn't let it go. I said at the point, I was like, oh, it hurts me that, you know, I thought you knew me better than that, and what you hear is not hatred, it's concern for the way the world is, and that's how I left it. Well, he kind of kept his distance for a while, and he recently came back to me at work and was saying to me, like, you know, I kept my distance because I don't really remember what we were talking about, but I remember the last time we were talking, you just sounded like you really hated white people. And I didn't say anything to him at the time because I've kind of stopped. This is present day. This is last week, actually. So I've kind of stopped talking at work. Like, I try not to speak unless I'm asked a question, and I try to give, like, same responses for everything. People ask me how I'm doing, I say, better than most, and keep it moving. I don't really get into conversations with people anymore. And I didn't say anything to him when he came to me again and said, like, you know, you sound like you hate white people. The 2 days later, he comes back, and I'm standing outside, and he's trying to, I guess, speak to me. He tries to give me dap or whatever. And I kind of just looked at him, and I was like, you know, I think that if you know, the last conversation we had, you came to a conclusion that I hate white people. And if you don't remember anything that I said after that, after you accused me of that, then, you know, we really shouldn't have any contact unless it's work-related whatsoever. And I was curious because so many of you do have more work experience than I do, do you think that that can possibly come back to bite me, or what type of ways I can prepare myself for that, or do you think that was kind of a correct action? Just kind of seeking some responses.
Which part is it that you're concerned about? You telling him that you think you all should just have work-related contact, or him, his allegation that you sounded like you hated white people?
His allegation more than anything. I don't, I do my job as much to a T as I can, but I also work somewhere where they don't have an updated policy. They haven't had an updated policy for 6 years. So it's kind of hard for me to go to the book and make sure I'm doing my job correctly, but I do it as correct as I've been trained to do it. And I try not to do anything incorrect at work. Like, I used to look at news online. I don't even do that anymore. So as far as my job, I'm not really concerned about me losing it based on what I do, but I am more concerned about his allegation and him being a white male, him being a favored white male at work by both black and white coworkers. You know, how, what do you think I can kind of prepare myself for as far as like a potential fallout, or if I should not even be concerned about it?
I would say it's definitely something to have in mind. And I would, the same thing that we said with the previous caller, White People Network. And I would just take this opportunity to really emphasize, white people are not ignorant about racism. You were talking about the Jesse Matthews case. This is a black male, and he was, or he's been charged with killing this little white girl. And they tried to pile on a whole bunch of other, like any white woman that, I mean, they almost said this literally, like any white woman that's missing in the state of Virginia, we're going to see if Jesse Matthews had anything to do with it. Like, that's almost literally what they said for a time during the end of 2014. Anyway, they know when a black person makes a statement like that, saying that I think something is incorrect about this, even though you didn't, you know, come out saying that the Klan was trying to get or anything like that, but just saying that you felt like something was incorrect about this. White people know more about the system of racism than we do. They immediately, and I've said this before, it really stands out. White people know that they have done such a thorough job terrorizing us. They know the fear that has been instilled in us, the confusion, all of that. They're very aware. It really sticks out to them. I mean, it's amazing when they bump into a black person that is like, no, I am not in denial. I'm willing to speak honestly and openly about racism. Like, whoa, that is like, wait a minute, time out. Okay, we got to pay attention to this person right here. I mean, that's pretty much what they do. It's like, whoop, we got one to slip through. We got to really pay attention to that one. You got to watch this one, da-da-da-da. And they might go about trying to get you off the job. On the hating white people thing, I would just go ahead and assume that he has told other people on the job at some point in time, especially the white people and probably some of the black people too, non-white people too, what you said, or not what you said, but that he thinks, or he might even lie. He might even lie and switch in and say that you did say that you hated white people or whatever. But I'm sure he's had some sort of dialogue with other people on the job about that, particularly the white people. If it does come up, I would just go right to that point. Did I say I hated white people? Any white people? Okay. Anybody? Did I say I hated anybody? When he says, if he's honest and he says no, I wouldn't have a whole lot more to say. Other than, so what is this based on? This quote unquote hatred that I have for anybody, and see what he says. But once you, if he's honest, now, if he's not honest, well, then the problem is right there.
And I would not go back to him to try to clarify the situation, because he could distort your narrative and comments. So I would just leave it alone. Don't address the matter. And if he does, let, just like Gus said, well, what do you believe I said? Don't give him anything to feed off of, because white people can distort your narrative and change it to what they want the narrative to be.
That was not intended. I do not intend to speak to him ever again, but yeah.
I thought that was great too. You saying, you know, we're just going to talk about workplace things and That's that. I thought that was great too. And I agree as well, not feeling compelled to be on the defensive, like, at all. I would behave like I didn't do anything incorrect, and the burden of proof should be on you to present evidence that, you know, I did something incorrect, or that I made, you know, a statement like that saying that I hate white people. I would not bring it up, pursue it at all. But yeah, I would definitely keep in mind and assume that he has told the other white people on the job. And you know, I would not, that's why I say all the time, you're not supposed to be talking about racism on the job. Not supposed to be talking about racism on the job. I haven't seen where it has worked out in a non-white person's favor before. Did you need any other commentary on that or processing through it?
No, I appreciate it. And I mean, that was kind of what I was planning on doing anyway. It was just I wanted some kind of verification that that would be the correct next step if that did happen. Like, just being like, I never said that, and never heard me say that. Because, like I said, when he came back, you know, last week and said that, I didn't say anything to him at all. It literally was like a 5-minute, like, pause. Just awkward silence, because I just looked at him. But yeah, that was what I was planning on doing. So I thank you all for the backup.
And do not admit to anything that they say. Deny it.
Yeah.
I heard some other folks that chimed in, I think male callers as well, who had comments.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I've called in before saying that I work at the airport for a rental car company. And one of the things that I've noticed working at this place is that the white people that are in charge don't have a real sense of safety. And thus, when it gets real busy, like during the weekends, cars are all over the place. And there is some sense of order as to where cars go, but, and where cars are parked, but overall it becomes a maze of where all the cars are. And I say this to say that I've talked to one of the members of the upper management and told them that, you know, the people that clean the cars, because this is a separate company that cleans the cars from the inside, that they park cars in such a way that it becomes difficult for us as employees to move the cars around without hitting them. Because if we get into a car accident at fault 3 times, we get dismissed. So I told him that, and I'm not sure if he's a white person. He looks non-white, but he has pale skin, so I'm not sure if he's a white person or not. But I told him this, and he told me that, you know, hey, we don't put yourself in this position and do the best that you can, which was not really an answer, in my opinion. So I have a question. So when you're in a workplace and you see dysfunction all over the place, how do you handle that when you have management that doesn't seem to be real interested in correcting that? So how do you manage your own thoughts and emotion so that you don't get too upset about it?
Is there some policies regarding how the procedures and practices should be in place regarding the car situations?
That is the thing. After an incident where I got written up, I asked for an employee handbook because I didn't receive one yet. I've been working there since October. I was told that they were just now constructing a handbook, which I thought was very interesting because this is like maybe the only job that I had that didn't have a handbook already in place. So there is no written down rules and regulations as to what needs to be done, what should be done, so on and so forth. So I'm not sure as to what is the official written down policy, but all I know is how things are how things run. It's a real lax place to work at, which has some benefits, but like I said, the management doesn't seem to be too interested in providing real safety measures so that accidents can be avoided.
My thought is that you report your concerns and that indicate that you believe that there are some policy violations that are being violated, and you've asked for what policies related to the situation be looked into and ask for a remedy to your report on that you believe that there are some violations being broken, and identify what you want as a remedy and wait to see what results you get, and even ask for results regarding your report of concerns in that you believe that there are some violations, safety violations, being that you've asked for the policies and procedures in place. You were told that they were none, but you believe this is a safety. You have some safety concerns, and identify specifically what they are.
Okay.
I would maybe ask for additional training, too, because you were saying that it seems like this becomes an issue, particularly when it gets busy, and it could be presented as, you know, perhaps we are in need of training for the efficient and safe way to park the vehicles once the traffic picked up. So it might just be a training problem that could correct everything. So you can potentially offer a solution as well.
Now, we did, because they do deal with cars and automobiles, they, for insurance reasons, they do provide some sort of training class. But that's more of a out of a book situation, not a practical one. So, I did earlier today think about what were some of the training exercises that this cleaning company has to go through, because they are the ones that are cleaning the cars from the inside, and they have to drive cars around, and there have been incidences where they get into accidents either because they're driving really fast or just not paying attention to what everybody else is doing. Because there will be times where we as the employees would get into the cars to drive them off to get them rented, and then they would put a parked car right behind us or on the side of us. And that becomes an issue because now we have to move, get out of the car that we're in to go into a different car. So that was a thought that came to my mind.
Now, you said you were written up?
Yes, it was on a different issue, but it wasn't a safety issue that came up, but I did ask about for a handbook, and I was told that there wasn't one.
I would, because you are concerned about it and you foresee that there may be a safety issue, I would not let it be overlooked, because you've been written up once. If another incident occurs, they could use that as a additional problem that you have been involved with in the workplace. So I would not let the your concerns about the safety situation go unaddressed, because, again, you want to address that right away so that you can show that you are proactive in doing whatever is necessary to remedy and resolve that situation. And like Gus says, if it means some additional training, if it means them looking at what's going on in terms of how logistically cars are being placed, you want it addressed right away because you don't want to leave yourself in any handicapped position that there's another incident that involves you that they use against you.
Thank you.
We are pretty much at the end. Do we have one more person? We had one other person who hasn't shared yet who had something on workplace racism.
Ooh. Can I be heard?
Yes.
Yes, just real quick. There was a conversation I had with a black female, and it seemed like she just wanted to talk about, I guess, something that had occurred. But there wasn't anyone around except for me and her. She said, I guess somebody had been, I guess, demoted or whatever. And she said their white supervisor, I guess, intervened in a conflict that occurred between a white person and this black female. And both of these females have been on the job for a decent amount of time, at least over 10 years. So the white woman ended up moving her seat or her desk to a new location. And she was saying that, I guess, the white people were trying to pit this black female up against another black female she sits next to. And the white woman that, I guess, works in the personnel area, she said she took the side of the white person. I'm thinking, well, you know, I'm not surprised by that. And I guess, yeah, the black female ended up getting demoted or whatever. That was one part. And there's this white male. He used the term. He said, you know what? We're going to call blank Metro Man, okay? So I said, whoa, what's that mean? And he said, well, that just means when you just have on certain colors. No, he didn't say colors. He said your clothes are coordinated. And I said, well, are your clothes coordinated? You know, sometimes is there any time where your clothes are coordinated? He said, well, sometimes. And I said, well, are your clothes coordinated today? And he says, well, I don't know. he says, well, I don't know. And he turns around and walks away. And he starts getting into it with this non-white male, the same guy that he took the batteries out of the remote and left it on Fox News. And the guy got angry. And he just says, you know what, I love spinning him up. And I said, well, why is that? You know, why do you like, you know, why do you like doing that? He said, well, I just like to see him just get upset. He said, he never can win an argument because it gets too emotional. You know, and I just laugh and, you know. And, I mean, he really does laugh until his face turns red. And that's just me observing this. So, just, you know, more learning.
That is fascinating. Wow. That's the total chimp out, though. Like, that's what I said. White people do this all the time. The noose that I was talking about where they did the same thing. They got the guy angry, and then they fired him. They do this all the time. This is like the bell curve, and, I mean, it's everything to just sit around and get the black people riled up, and they just crack up laughing. Like, this is the greatest fun in the world. We just, you know, need to have a better understanding that is unfortunately the world we live in. 5098, did you have anything you wanted to get in before we wrap up?
Yes, I do. First of all, greetings, everyone, and it's been a lot of constructive information. I got a couple things. I'm a student, And I'm taking my first online course. It's a physical science, pretty challenging. And so they had an online lab. And so you're supposed to email the professor when you have problems because you're not allowed to do the personal phone call thing for obvious reasons. And this happened to be a Sunday, and we had about 8 emails that had gone back and forth. And so I was thinking from my perspective, let me be mindful. I mean, this I'm not getting satisfaction. The lab isn't coming out right, and I'm not getting a lot of clarity to my emails. So I emailed her, and by the way, she's a white woman from Mississippi. And I emailed her, said, is there someone else I could go to? And the reason I said that is because it's a Sunday, and 8 or 9 emails have transpired, and I'm still not being able to get, I'm still not able to achieve clarity of what I need. And that Monday, I saw her in the hallway, and she was highly upset and said that was very disrespectful. And I said, well, what do you mean? And she said, you know, I'm your instructor, and you're asking for someone else. And I said, it's a Sunday. And I was trying to be mindful, thinking that you have family and other things going on. And I thought maybe if there was a second go-to person, I could alleviate these emails and go and direct it to someone else. Well, someone had passed this exchange in the hallway and said that I was aggressive towards her and so forth. Well, there was a security guard, black, who happened to be black, that was sitting there. And he said that was not the case. He actually went and went to bed. I didn't even know any of this transpired. That's one of the incidents. Luckily, this person was sitting there, and I was just trying to get clarity, saying, hey, you know, is there a second person? It's a Sunday. The other thing is, there is a book called Invitation to Health by a woman by the name of Diane Hales. And in this book, it has everything from sexually transmitted diseases to breast cancer to cancer to advanced directives, anything to do with health. Well, I noticed in this book, she mentions black people. They drink less on campus. They don't abuse drugs less than their white counterpart, et cetera, et cetera. And she said black people suffer from stress. And so when I wrote a paper on this particular book, I noticed I called her a cowardly scholar because she made it look like she didn't say why we suffer higher incidence of high blood pressure and stress. It's almost like a stress fairy sprinkles hyper stress fairies on black this, you know. And because she didn't see any cause and effect, so I attacked her as a cowardly scholar, and I said the greatest. So we're supposed to write about some type of illness that you and your family suffers, and of course they left the door open. I just walked in, and I was able to cite Dr. Wellstein and Neely Fuller Jr. And I said, white supremacy racism is the greatest health risk on the planet. And, of course, it was so many sources that I could cite that I did. Now, ever since I wrote this paper, they have been looking at me very funny now. And so my question to anyone out there is, did I open up Pandora's box here? I mean, the door was left open because she was not honest in the book about the type of why black people suffer high blood pressure higher than their counterparts, the fact that black people use drugs less on college campuses, alcohol less, cigarettes less, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But yet the war on drugs, as we all know, is pretty much centered in the black community. And so I felt that, I feel like in an academic environment, white supremacy racism is the greatest health risk on the planet. And sources were numerous, and I even threw a couple current events in just to put some icing on the cake. Am I in for a long ride? Did I open up Pandora's box? Is my question to anyone out there.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I am thinking about how Gus would respond, and my response would be I would not bring anything about racism, white supremacy, and the whites in the workplace. Because white people are very informed on racism, what it is and how it works. And I think that it can hurt you rather than help you.
Yep. To answer your question, I would say yes. And I would just, you know, remind folks, Dr. Welsing, I think she's shared many times through the years how she was denied tenure at Howard, which is an HBCU, so they tell me. Dr. Umar. He was on the program and he talked about how he would do the same thing, that, you know, he would bring up racism, white supremacy through the course of securing his doctorate. And he talked on the program about how that ended up making him take a lot longer to finish his degree. And it made it so challenging that he almost at many points gave up on the idea of getting his degree. And he talked about that in detail. And he said if he had it to do over again, he would not have brought up racism. He would have just got his diploma as efficiently as possible and then, you know, bring all that stuff up on your free time or once you have your degree or what have you. And Dr. Welsing has said the same thing. I would just say the same thing that I say in all circumstances. White people are very informed about racism. Exactly what I said before. And that sticks out like immediately. That's like, uh-oh. Got to keep your eye on that one over there. Man, got to do something about him. Maybe we can see if we can mess up a few of his credits so he has to give us, you know, an extra $10,000 or whatever. That's what it is. Like, really understanding that we have enemies and how enemies of black people function in all settings. That is just an academic institution of white supremacy. But I am same thing I said before. I'm sure the white faculty at your institution, I'm sure they have had conversations about you and your paper and ramifications and the whole nine. That's just what it is. And, you know, it'll be interesting to learn. You can see what happens down the road. And if this has any implications, if they make things more different or if they just, you know, are seeming to be paying attention to you, being alert to what you say or what you write in the future, it'll be an opportunity to learn. You can update us on how things go.
Yeah, one other thing is, you know, it's everything that's been shared tonight has been so useful. But and people have said it even on the work on the workplace. They create an environment like, hey, this is an academic. You know, we could do this in a scholarly way. And then, you know, I ended up taking the bait. You know, and I'll learn from this. But, you know, it's almost like, hey, you know, we could have an intelligent discussion about this. In reality, that's not the case. I identified my thought process and the ideas, like that Godfather movie, when he was talking to Sony and they were having a meeting, he said, "You never let no one know what you're thinking." I forgot, it was a Godfather 2 or something, you know. And I fell for it, you know what I mean. And but I got a free ride all the way through graduate school, so we'll see how this plans out. So anyway, thank you, everybody.
Keep us up. Hang on, because we went over time, and I'm not hanging out for the extra today. We should be back on Monday, though. Not Sunday, but Monday. The land was ours. Andrew Carl, he was brought up when Dr. Nathan Connolly was with us like 10 days ago. And it's all about how white people, economic terrorism, conspired to steal property from black people, particularly beachfront property. And you see some of that still going on 2015, but he should be here on Monday. Very great, very interesting book. The Land Was Ours. We should also be here a few other days in the week as well. If you get confused, have problems, chaos, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks everyone for tuning in. I hope it was constructive, and we'll be back, I guess, like 48 hours or so. The male person that was going to do the, prayer, feel free.
Thank you. Creator, we are in a system of racism, white supremacy. Creator, help black people to understand that white people practice racism, white supremacy in all areas of people activity, economics, education, entertainment, health, labor, law, politics, religion, sex, and war, for the ultimate purpose of white genetic survival and to prevent white genetic annihilation on planet Earth. Creator, help black people to systematically transform their behavior for the purpose of justice and guaranteeing that no black person is mistreated and guaranteeing that the black person that needs the help the most gets the most constructive help. Creator, help black people resolve and remedy immediately the problems of racism, white supremacy, and to replace it with justice immediately.
Jay. Context of White Supremacy signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.